Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Olé, olé. C'est la Peña Bayona, on est tous là, allez les gars, encore une fois. Allez, allez.
So New Zealand against France, 2007 Rugby World Cup. France 20, New Zealand 18. It's one of the biggest turning points in New Zealand rugby history, I think. Yeah. It's one of the games you look at the kind of, we talked about in the 87, you know, the lead up to that tournament, I think was a huge turning point. This is another one. And then I think the All Blacks at the minute, you know, I think last year's World Cup was the beginning of one, and I think what we're going to see is going to be another one. This game is one of the biggest days in New Zealand rugby history. It's one of the most talked about. You go back and you look at last year, before the opening game of the 2023 World Cup, there was an awful lot of talk about this game because New Zealand were playing France in France again.
With every Rugby World Cup that we've had since 2007, from 2011 through to now, this game is brought up constantly.
Yeah.
Within 2011 and 2015, it was about the curse of New Zealand.
Yeah.
You know, them winning the World Cup in 2011 wasn't enough. It was like, we have to go and win it multiple times in a row. We have to prove that we're an utterly dominant force because we failed to do it in 2007. In 2019, it was the same thing. We can't let anybody else in on this. And in 2023, it was much the same when South Africa had won a World Cup.
Yeah.
Every single time. You say it's one of the most important moments of New Zealand rugby history. It is. It's also one of the most of the Rugby World Cup in general.
I'd agree.
We're about to talk about.
And yet, having watched this game back, having been over this full tournament up to this point, having looked at the full sweep of history it produces and it comes from, I have one real question.
Okay.
Why the hell is it in Cardiff?
It's a weird decision, isn't it?
It's such a weird decision. I know they were hoping France would win their group so they'd get a game in Paris instead, right, for the quarterfinal.
But do the other side of the draw, send them to Cardiff.
Yeah. Why aren't you sending Wales to Cardiff?
Yeah, the other side of the draw, I don't know, has Wales and England in it.
Yeah.
Like, this game sells out, but still.
I guess they knew they'd have the All Blacks here, right? Mm. And the All Blacks will sell no matter where in the world they are. And they thought, well, Wales might not get out of the group. And if it, you know, if it's Fiji against someone, against South Africa maybe, maybe that won't go so well. But all the same, why is this, why take that chance? I know contractually, you know, in order to get Wales and Scotland to vote for them, they offered them a couple of games at home.
And to get out the Super 8 that England were offering them.
Which is all bullshit. But, right, so part of the deal was Cardiff would get a quarterfinal.
Yeah.
I guess they went for the All Blacks because they knew it was the safest sell.
Yeah.
But why take the risk of giving France his own game? It's insane. It's such a mad, mad decision. And I feel like no one talks about this. We all just go, well, it was weird, wasn't it? You know, they lost their game to Argentina, so suddenly you had to go to Cardiff. Ooh. No one goes, what? Why was this? What was that all about?
Do you want to know the funniest bit about this being in Cardiff?
I'd love to.
Me,
to.
Yeah. That I didn't know about that until I watched it back. The bit about half an hour in when the crowd all starts singing Fields of Athenry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because people had bought the ticket for the game where if Ireland finished second in the group, they would have got through to the semi-final, the quarter-final. Like, clearly everyone expected France would win the group and Ireland come second and that's it.
Yeah.
Rather than Argentina obliterate France in game one and then France coast through and dominate the rest of the pool, Ireland don't get out.
It's an absolutely wild world. Well, yeah, you have both hymns and arias and Fields of Athenry sung in New Zealand versus France.
It's brilliant.
In a French-hosted World Cup.
Like, in the quarterfinals. Well, yeah. It's not like it's one of these days out where it's just kind of, oh, we'll go along because there's a test match happening at the stadium. Yeah. You know, like an exhibition match. No, no, this is a quarterfinal of the World Cup.
I seem to have it in my mind that this stadium was partly empty, and it wasn't. Like, it is packed.
Yeah, it is.
Which is great. But I think there is a weird, weird atmosphere.
It's very mixed,
Cardiff,
isn't it?
Yeah.
That you have, like, I don't know, when it's a certain nation's home game, you get like a sense of Scottishness, a sense of Welshness, a sense of Frenchness that comes with it. Whereas there's a lot of French fans there.
Yeah.
There's, I think, quite a lot of All Blacks fans there as well.
They make the point a lot of All Blacks fans have booked their trip in advance because they knew they'd win the group. Because, of course, they were the All Blacks in this era where they were so dominant, they won
up to this point, they had never lost a pool game.
Yeah. I mean, they didn't do that until last year.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, they were fairly sure. A lot of All Blacks fans booked their trips over. Before the game, they were talking about how, like, Cardiff was a sea of black that day. You know, it could have been all Ospreys fans. It could have been, you know, entirely just there'd been a lot of funerals going on in the area.
Yeah.
Whatever. But they were saying Cardiff was very, very black that day. And yet you don't necessarily hear it in the crowd.
No. No. It's interesting because there is an air of nervousness the whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, the
longer the game goes on as well, it builds.
The pre-game kickoff is the only time, and I have seen a lot of this guy play rugby, you know, both for this podcast and in just general growing up watching rugby, it's the only time I've seen Richie McCaw look nervous, ever, was the coin toss that he did before the game with Inverness.
2011 as well, the final.
Okay, yeah. Because I feel like by then he'd kind of figured, no, I've got to, you know, I'm the big dog now.
I mean, he talked about, and I think we mentioned this when we did the 2011 series, that was the most nervous he'd ever felt in his life, was that final in 2011. And that shows in all the All Blacks feel that way.
Yeah.
There's an interesting quote, actually, I'll land on as well. Yeah. So Richie McCaw said the decision made by him and Graham Henry and Wayne Smith, the coaching trio, the key leaders within the All Blacks, right, made a decision between, you know, him as the captain and them as the coaches, didn't involve the rest of the leadership group, didn't involve the rest of the players.
Okay.
That the day of this quarterfinal, they wouldn't, as he put it, push the emotional button.
Okay.
Because they felt, right, they could put in the, you know, real emotional efforts, really give them an emotional team talk, give them emotional build-up in the days leading in.
Like what we're saying about the 1987 final.
Yeah, where France really, really went in on it.
Yeah.
And France, you know, they all sat down
and, it was just
and they talked
too much
for hours.
For
yeah, and they were too emotional.
What motivated
they were completely
them. Yeah.
off. New Zealand talked about doing a big emotional charge for this game.
Okay.
And then Graham Henry and Richie McCaw jointly made the decision that they wanted to hold that and do that for the semi-final. Because they thought they'd be tougher games.
Wow.
So McCaw said that's a big regret.
You know what's really weird? Like, we're talking about this like the All Blacks knew it was their final.
Yeah.
Because they didn't.
They didn't.
You're
they
right,
didn't.
They didn't. And as I say, McCaw looks nervous there. McCaw played another couple of World Cup quarterfinals after this and probably didn't care that much.
This was his first as captain, I guess, is the thing.
Yeah, I guess so. But regardless, he played in a lot of World Cup a lot of World Cup knockout games, I should say.
Yeah, yeah.
And this, as far as he knew, wasn't going to be the biggest one. They were expected to at least make the final.
Yeah.
If not win it.
Yeah. They were nailed on favourites for this tournament. Right. People gave Australia an outside sniff. People gave South Africa a bit of a sniff.
Especially once France had lost the opening day to Argentina.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I think we do need to talk around the context of where these two teams are at.
Yeah.
But first of all, who are you?
Oh, I'm Robbie or Squidge, whatever you call me. I don't really care. Who are you?
I'm Will Owen. Anyway.
Cool. Congratulations.
Thank you. Where France are at this tournament...
It's Cardiff.
It's Cardiff. For
Why?
Some stupid reason.
Why?
But they lost the opening game to Argentina, as you said.
Yeah.
We really went into that. Argentina did press the emotional button that day.
Yeah.
Really came out, blew them away, scored some brilliant tries. And after that, right, I think that's the focal point of their group, of what happened. But France have been excellent in every game after that. They clearly responded because, sure, it's easy to put 90 points on Namibia. Sure, it's easy to blow away Georgia and put 60 points on them.
I mean, Ireland didn't do either
of these. Yeah, that is true. Ireland scraped past both of them. And as we discussed, like, people are probably slightly harsh on this Ireland team and just how shit they may have been in this tournament. And yet France, they did their research on these teams and they did play comprehensively, like, so well that you look at them and you go like, oh, maybe these guys are contenders.
Yeah. Although, the thing is, right, it's a full-on, of this era, you never know which French team is going to turn up.
Indeed.
Because they were utter dog shit against Argentina.
Yeah.
And then they were fantastic against most of the opposition that they played since.
And they got better with each game, I think.
Yeah, but then the Ireland game, they had patches where they just switched off completely.
Yeah.
And they were great for large swathes of it. Then they just, like, suddenly fall apart. And they didn't seem to have an 80-minute performance in them, right? And the narrative that's built up around this World Cup is they put one 80-minute performance together, and it was this day against the All Blacks in order to beat them. And I don't think that's what happened, having watched this back.
Yeah. I think this game is best known for probably five things, right?
Yeah.
And we'll get into them all individually, but one of them is a decision that is made by the New Zealand team and management and so on.
Sure.
One of them is a decision that's made by an official.
Yeah.
One of them is a specific performance that a player has.
Yeah.
One of them is about a certain specific war dance that happens before the game. I don't know what that could be. Yeah. And the other one is about the kit that the All Blacks are wearing.
Yeah.
I mean, we call them the All Blacks.
This all sits under the result, right? Which the result is the things that we'll talk about.
Yes.
And this is talked about as an all-time great Rugby World Cup match. Having watched it today, I think it's an all-time great Rugby World Cup result. I think the drama in the last kind of 20 minutes is phenomenal.
Yeah.
I don't think it's an all-time great game the whole way through in the way South Africa...
It's an all-time occasion.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's it. Like, it's an all-time result, an all-time occasion.
If this was a pool game and you change New Zealand's name to England, it would not be a particularly entertaining game. If you change France's name to Wales...
The fact is they're nailed-on favourites and they get knocked out and, you know, all of this... I think it's remembered more fondly because of the drama of the last 20 minutes. Yeah. I think it's a brilliant final 20
minutes.
And those
five things we're on about. Like the narrative that surrounds those five things makes this game so strong.
Yeah.
And I came away at the final whistle, I was like, holy shit, that's one of my favourite games we've covered on this podcast. For different reasons than I thought it might be. Mm. And we'll obviously get into that.
From a purely entertainment perspective, right, the 87 semi-final between France and Australia is a better game.
Yes, right? Agreed.
From a drama point of view, this might be the most thrilling, enthralling, and surprising,
controversial.
Yeah. You know, like there's an old Max Boyes quote, right? That I don't mind losing so long as it's controversial.
Yes.
And there's a big vibe of that to this game.
Yeah, you're really into your Max Boyes at the moment.
A lot. I ended up doing a lot of Max Boyes research for a video that will probably be out around the time this podcast comes out.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I've listened to a lot of Max Boyes in the last few weeks and read a lot of Max Boyes. Yeah. I've listened to a lot of like interviews and stuff.
It's a lot of Hirith shit going on.
When I mentioned Max Boyes in previous videos on the channel, I kind of would listen to one song and I went like, no, if I'm going to talk about it, I want to properly like get it.
Yeah, lean into it.
So, yeah, there's a level of research that's got deeper as the channel's gone on.
I'm happy for you. I'm very happy for you. But yeah, I think the style of play was different to what I expected.
Yeah.
This is, by some distance, I think the most kick-heavy game in the 2007 tournament.
It's certainly
both teams are really reluctant to play anywhere in their own half.
Well, Argentina are incredibly kick-heavy the entire way through.
Yeah.
Right. And then it's probably these two teams next. Oh, no, France are certainly. France here in this game kick an awful lot. New Zealand, I don't think, kick enough. And we'll get onto this as we go in.
Yeah.
But I think it's a real problem for New
Zealand. I think in the first half, there's a lot of sparring, like kick battles that are going on, which weren't particularly high quality in this tournament generally. But in this game, I thought they really were. They were really interesting.
It comes back to what we're saying about the emotional button, right?
Mm.
I don't think New Zealand realised the game they are in for most of its run.
Yeah.
I think they spent a long time thinking they're in an extra pool game.
Yeah.
And then they realised, like, oh, shit, no, this is a quarterfinal. This is a big one. This could be our final game of the tournament. We could be heading home.
Yeah.
And it takes them a long time to realise that. And when it does hit them, it hits them as shock and panic.
An embarrassment, I think.
Yeah.
And once again, like, this day is so horribly remembered that these players, when talked about in the context of this game, aren't talked about like All Blacks.
No.
They're talked as like children wearing this embarrassing, clumsy, grey kit that's not them, that they're not actually representing what the All Blacks are as a brand.
Yeah.
And again, it's just fascinating seeing the way that this goes, and we'll get into it properly. But for the first half, the All Blacks are scoreboard dominant, right?
Yeah.
They are 13-0 up just before half time. And you go like, oh, these are the same guys that are ridiculed to this day. For this is the exact performance that it's for.
Yeah.
How mad is that?
It's just gone on. It just followed them forever.
And yet for 40 minutes of it, they were winning.
Yeah.
For more than 40 minutes. For 40 minutes of it, they were 13-0 up, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was the amazing thing, right? I didn't realise how far ahead they were at half-time.
Me neither.
I didn't realise how big their lead was and how much in control they were. And yet I also think it, and again, we'll get onto this, but like lulls them to false sense of security an awful lot.
Yeah.
So coming into this game, right, the All Blacks had absolutely smashed through their pool stage.
Yeah.
They'd absolutely dominated everyone they played.
Nobody had competed with them. People barely managed to score tries past them.
Yeah.
Other than Rui Cordeiro for Portugal.
Who was magnificent and was the greatest, I think, ever.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, like, their game before this, right, they went 85-8 against Romania.
Yeah.
You know, like, it was completely 40-0 in the next biggest pool game against Scotland, who were the other team that got out of the group. Like, there wasn't a challenging game.
No.
You know, they put 100 points past Portugal. They beat Italy really comprehensively. Like, every game they won by at least 3 scores. Like, their game against the other team that got the group was 40-0.
Yeah.
Like, that's the level in which, you know, they didn't compete. They'd won the Rugby Championship that year, or the Tri Nations, as it was at the time, rather, and they'd kind of headed into this a proper canter, just the best team in the world, who cared? They had, though, and this is an interesting theme that keeps coming up in this tournament, right? That summer, played a test series against France.
Why do they keep doing this?
In fairness, they didn't expect this to happen, yeah, right?
Go for a second.
They played two games against France.
Okay.
Okay. I'm amazed this didn't come up on commentary either time. The first game, 42-11 to New Zealand.
That's pretty comprehensive.
Aaron Mulger with two tries and man of the match performance, which, when we got to the team, you know, there's a controversy here. Though, in fairness, it's a remarkably similar All Blacks team to the one that plays. It's a very different French team.
Really?
There's a lot of players whose name I don't recognise. Jean-Philippe Grandclaude.
Brilliant.
Centre, you know, all of these guys. Benjamin Boyer, who a 10 who got sin-binned. Olivier Magne played. Pascal Pape was captain. Honestly. However, the second test, right? New Zealand won 61-10.
That's so strange.
Julian Laharague was on the wing.
No.
For France.
Good player. As was Nicolas Laharague.
Yeah.
But my word, that is an extreme difference to what happens here.
And that they put Nick Evans at 10 for that second game, where they'd had Carter start the first one.
Okay.
In order to give him a bit of game time. Give him a bit of game time. In case he needs it in the World Cup, you know.
Yeah.
Carter won't get injured. But if he does, they want him to have game time.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
So they went in on enormous confidence, right? Not only had they won every pool game at a canter, they'd beaten France twice that calendar year, right? Those were both in June. So you're looking at 3 or 4 months before this game. They were battering, absolutely battering, the same opposition. And so we arrive at the game. So we arrive at the draw. And the commentator mentions that the odds on an England v France semi-final were 100-1 before that day.
Yeah. That very morning, you could have put a bet on that and got 100 quid back from it for a quid, for anyone who doesn't know what betting is.
Thank you.
Yeah. And England worked really hard to win that quarterfinal. They were absolutely outstanding. And yet, I feel like context is such an interesting thing for this because, again, there is something about the grey kit that makes you think like, oh, that's not the All Blacks. This is this sloppy team that is talked down upon.
Yeah.
And weirdly, that's a part of it, the grey kit that they had to wear for whatever reason. Well, the reason being France were the home team and got to decide that. I think that was potentially a part of the deal with them having to play in Cardiff.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fascinating thing, that grey kit, because it's talked about a lot in New Zealand.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's conjecture, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think we've ever heard any of the actual coaches come out and say anything.
Mm.
There are players who've said they thought it was a distraction, they didn't like that kit.
Yeah.
Graham Henry's autobiography blames virtually everything else for the loss, but not that kit.
Okay.
But yeah, there was a draw done that morning. And so there is an article on ESPN Scrum from the time, from October 2007, saying New Zealand will wear grey for tonight's World Cup quarterfinal against France. It was confirmed this morning. France won the coin toss that determined what colour shirts they would use, and their first choice kit is dark blue. The All Blacks are asked to wear the second strip. There was a possibility of a reprieve that they could have allowed both of them to wear France, but they chose not to and wouldn't allow New Zealand to wear their black shirt.
Okay. On one hand, I don't think I've ever come across or heard of a sports team who was more reluctant to wear their away kit than the All Blacks.
Yeah. I mean, the headline of the article, by the way, right, is the All Blacks fade to grey.
Okay.
Which is a prescient for its time type.
Yeah, yeah. On the other hand of that.
Yeah.
It's a fucking kit.
Exactly, yeah.
So, if you're wearing bibs in training, you look up and you go, okay, I'm on the team with the bibs on it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to pass to the people without bibs on.
So I interviewed...
The best rugby players in the world.
Yeah, I did a run of interviews for the URC a few years ago where they had a different captain and coach from each team came in and talked, right? And during the Dragons one, I can't remember for whatever reason, it was Rodri Williams, the scrum half, and Dean Ryan, who was coach at the time, before he just disappeared for 6 months and then eventually got let go.
Who'd have thought he'd come up on this? Anyway.
But they ended up discussing kits, and I asked them, like, you know, do you ever have that moment of like really hating the kit you're wearing or being reluctant to put it on or anything? And Roger Williams said, yeah, I've had kits I've had to put on where I've gone like, what the hell is this? But it's never like, you forget it the moment you've got the match on,
yeah,
you know?
But
like Dean Ryan said like, yeah, I've had kits I hate, but like, you just get over it.
Yeah.
You know?
And if you're the best rugby team in the world, are you the best rugby team in the world if you suddenly don't play as well by a dramatic drop-off if you suddenly wear a different colour shirt?
I also think that is massively overblown.
It is. I think
people didn't like
that's my
it,
point.
So they're looking at it.
And
you
it's
know.
A scapegoat but, at the end yeah. of the day. They want this endless list of things for New Zealand to blame on
but, yeah.
that avoids the fact that they could have won the game. And the one thing that I didn't expect to come on here and say after watching the game...
Yeah.
So we've watched probably 100-odd games plus for this podcast.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't know if there is a game... where the losing team has actively blown it harder than this.
I agree. So the narrative around this game is France come out and they are brilliant and Ducitor inspires them to this unbelievable performance.
Which isn't untrue.
Yes and no. I think France defensively are great.
They are.
I think they're smarter and their game management is better than New Zealand's.
I agree with that.
I don't think they're a better team on any stretch.
I think they're limited.
Yeah. I think this is... And I hate this. I hate this because this happens so often, right? It's happened a lot of England in the Six Nations that's going on at the minute as we record this. It happened a lot of Wales under Gatland. It happens with the Springboks an awful lot, especially during the 2023 World Cup, less so in 2019. But it happens a lot, right? Where a team is very good, but they're good through a kicking and a forward-based game and a defensive game. So everyone goes, well, we were just shit. You know, the other team was just shit on the day. The other team was bad and that's why the other team won. Like, no. They won because they're good and they limited and shut down the opposition and they forced them into errors and they forced them into mistakes and they forced them into being so far below their standards, right? That one, Rome Wales went on under Gatland when they had won 17 games in a row or something, right? And 13, I think it was. And every single one of them, the opposition said, oh, that's just the worst game we've played in ages and we shouldn't have lost that game, right? I hate it when they do this, but I think New Zealand lost this game more than France won it.
100% agreed. I say France are limited.
Yeah.
New Zealand, as soon as you take out their kind of offload game,
yeah.
this, you know, the support play that they've been tearing people up with
yeah.
this whole tournament, as soon as that's gone, they just aren't really much of a team.
No.
They aren't really doing much that's inspiring. And that shocked me
yeah.
about this.
Yeah. I thought New Zealand in the last 20 minutes, and again, we'll get onto it in specifics, were atrocious.
Shite.
Atrocious.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't expect, you know, like a middle-of-the-table club team to be that bad in their situation.
Because they definitely should have been further ahead when they were
yeah.
ahead.
Yeah.
That's definitely true. But obviously, it feels a little bit more hindsighty, a little bit more
yeah,
nitpicky
yeah.
to say that. But that last 20 minutes, there were active choices that they could have made that would have rescued that.
Yeah.
And they didn't.
Yeah.
But we'll get into the exact
We'll get into that. We'll get into that. I think we should look at the teams.
Let's look at the teams.
So, should we look at New Zealand first?
Let's
go
to New Zealand
them?
First, yeah.
There's a few big calls in this team.
Yeah.
The first one is Liam McDonald at fullback.
Yeah.
Who comes in quite controversially. He perhaps wasn't the first choice option. I don't entirely know what the rationale there, if they wanted an extra kicking option. Since
I think
he was
experience
a
is part of
experience,
it.
Yeah.
yeah. He is a kicking option. He's got a massive boot on him. And they probably anticipated...
50 caps to his name.
Yeah, France are going to kick a lot.
And Graham Henry says pre-game, I expect there to be a lot of kicking.
Yeah, yeah. Especially to say France had named Damien Trai at fullback for pretty much
yeah.
the exact same reason. That you can probably tell that's the way they're going. Instead of Poitrineau, who's going to run the ball at you and do stupid shit all day. Instead, Damien Trai, very sensible.
Mm.
We'll put the ball over the top every time. I think Leon McDonald, they kind of thought, it's a similar situation with him and Muliaina.
Yeah,
And obviously they still get Muliaina on the team sheet and they put him into it outside centre.
Yeah, which is a mad thing. So you have Muliaina and Luke McAllister in the centres. The very big controversy here was Noah Major.
Yeah.
You know, they have Mononu in the squad as well, I say Atoiava.
Yeah,
as options.
Conrad Smith played really well in the group stages, but was
they
a young
go
kid at this
for
point.
Muliaina, who is not a 13,
no.
can play there, but is not a 13. And Luke McAllister, because they want him as an extra kicking option. They
yeah.
want him as an extra.
Muliaina is a super rugby level 13,
yeah.
Who could slot in there.
And
off
a
world class
fullback.
Or whatever, but he's a world class fullback.
Yeah.
And so Muliaina, like when he has the ball in his hands, is brilliant in this game because he's bloody Mills Muliaina.
Yeah.
What do you expect? But. there's a few times where you look at him and you go, like, you do not look like a centre at all.
No.
The rest of the back line, Sivivota and Rokothoko on the wings, is hard to argue with. Both have been lethal in terms of try scoring in this tournament. Both, I think, to a man, quicker than their opposite numbers, even though technically they might have a couple of things that they give away on. Dan Carter's in at 10.
Yeah.
Which is a no-brainer because he's been ridiculously good all tournament.
He'd been struggling with an injury the week leading in.
Yes, he'd his calf. Struggling,
yeah, struggling with a calf injury. And there was a lot of talk in the week of, will he make it? Will he be available? Will he be an option for this game? And they went, we're just going to put him in regardless.
Okay.
And in the end, he makes it about the 55th minute before it just gives way under him.
Yeah.
Right. And I thought, because I knew Carter went off in this game, there was going to be a big moment, similar to in 2011, where he goes down injured and everyone goes into panic. There isn't. He just cuts to him and
limps
stands.
Off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because his calf just went from under him. And He spent 50 minutes playing reasonably well.
I think he played really well.
I don't think he's at the peak of his powers.
No, I agree.
And I think you can tell he's injured. There's a kick he puts out, like, really awkwardly. He hits, you know, really differently in the first few minutes. Just because I think he's still adjusting to playing on an injured foot.
I think he played really, really well. But it's like a 7 out of 10 Dan Carter performance.
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
Is above basically any other fly half he's playing in this tournament, aside from Lionel Boxis. But, yeah. The New Zealand pack, so... big names. It's one of those weird situations where Carl Heyman and Cedric Caymans had played on the same pitch. I like it when that happens.
Yeah.
But it's a big pack. They've got Jerry Collins in there. They've got Ali Williams in there. Rodney Soo-Oyalo in at number 8, picked over Chris Marsoe. Both of them have been playing really well in the group stage. So I think that they opted for the slightly bigger carrier out of the two.
The big call in that pack is Keith Robinson, who's back from injury, goes straight in. Ahead of Chris Jack, who perhaps been preferred, you'd expect.
Yeah.
But yeah, they bring him in more as a kind of standard, like, set-piece option.
Yeah.
You know, kind of more conservative selection. Figuring it's a World Cup quarterfinal, you know. It's not an extra pool game. Let's bear that mindset in mind.
Yeah. And then bench-wise, it's not as strong a bench as a starting lineup. Like, you don't look at this and go, like, this is a full 23 who are going to win a World Cup.
It's a lot of, like, oh yeah, he's an All Black.
Yeah.
On the bench.
Such as Brendan Leonard. Such
Ospreys
as
legend, Zebra legend,
indeed,
Brendan Leonard.
Such as Nemia Tialata. Asai Toiava's a very good player.
Yeah.
But again, I didn't look at him and think, like, oh yeah, he should be starting. He should be above Sitifani Sivivarti.
Nick Evans, brilliant, brilliant player, remembered for his time at Harlequins rather than his All Blacks career.
Yeah, yeah. Very good second choice fly off to off, though.
Yeah.
But yeah. Anything else on New Zealand or want to go on to France?
No, I think that about covers it. Byron Kelleher's in the 9 shirt as well, which I guess comes up as we go on.
Yes. France.
France go for a similar team to the one that played the second half of the pool stage with, as you said, the notable change of Damien Trai coming in at fullback.
Yes. They do slightly pick on form, I think. There's a couple of players like Clément Poitrineau is put onto the bench who had been on good form, but I think they knew exactly what they would get from him.
Sure.
And as you say, they go for the more conservative option in Trai. There's one particular form pick that comes as a result of their last pool game against Georgia in the form of Yionel.
Yionel Boxis started one of the most famous games of rugby of all time at fly half.
Did you know that?
I did, yeah.
I think I knew that, but I didn't remember it.
Yeah,
like, I saw him lining up for the anthem, I was like, holy fuck, Yionel's in this.
Yeah, it's Yionel time. No, I remembered this and I saw it and I was just delighted all over again when I saw his name on the team sheet there.
It's like if, you know, you sat down and watched The Godfather and then suddenly Gromit from Wallace and Gromit's in it.
He is. Have you seen The Godfather?
Yeah,
loads. Yeah, he gives that speech when he gets kicked out and has to go back to Italy. Gromit comes in and he does his, like, there's like a whole monologue, but he does it just with his eyebrows because he's Gromit.
It's really good.
Good film.
But that was how it felt. It's like, oh, that's my guy, you know. So I was very pleased to see him. They go with Jean-Baptiste Elisalde at 9.
Yes, who'd been playing really well.
He had been, yeah. He's been excellent.
So Jojon and Marty starting the centres together.
Yes.
Again, a safer combination, perhaps.
But very attacking-minded still.
Yeah. Marty gives an extra kicking option. You know, he loves that, like, that slid grubber from the 13 channel. A lot of this feels built around the kicking game, which, you know, we get into. Yeah, other thing that's brought up in commentary is France have, of course, on the bench, Christophe Dominici, and starting as captain, Raphael Imbenez, who both played in that famous semi-final against France, between France and New Zealand in 1999. And then you've also got Serge Betson was in the squad but didn't play in that game.
Yeah. Of course, France won that game.
Yeah.
So these guys have beaten the All Blacks in a World Cup knockout game before.
From an all-time great comeback, from having been behind.
That's a rarity in players of any era of rugby.
Yeah.
Is somebody who has beaten the All Blacks in a knockout game in a World Cup
having a chance
several
to do
years
it again.
Ago. Having a chance to do it again. I think that's an inspired decision, putting Dominici on the bench as somebody who can come in and go, no, this is what we need to do.
I've done it. I've scored in that game.
Yeah. By the way, just Rafael Embenez is a class act. I absolutely love him as captain.
He's hanging on for dear life to the one-arm throw into line-outs. Everyone else has moved on, right? And there's one line-out that he horrendously overthrows in the first half that anyone would get right nowadays because everyone throws in with two hands. But he's gone, no, I shall not. And just continued throwing in with one hand so that he can cling on to that technique with the other hand.
I absolutely love Embenez. He's nails, if nothing else. And sometimes he is nothing
else.
He's
one of the only hookers who you hear about having a material impact on scrums.
Right? Yes.
And the scrum goes notably worse when he comes off.
Yeah.
And I think Dimitri Zarzewski comes to the bench and it is unreal.
He's
so unbelievable.
Good.
And we'll get on to that.
But he's
which
about
I keep saying,
a tenth
but...
of Ibanez's size.
Yeah. Ibanez is great value. And leads a lot of this. And if you read French side of this, there's a lot of Ibanez talking about this and how they prepared for this game and how they emotionally got it right and so on and so forth.
Can I talk about the when the teams come out? What happens
I would
there?
Love you to.
The teams do come out. The All Blacks in their grey kit. France strip off and they're, you know, in their standard blue. And they line up for the national anthems. And you're pumped for this game because you know what's about to come. And then you start to hear... God defend New Zealand. I don't mind God defend New Zealand. I think it's a perfectly fine national anthem. Yeah. You know, I think when it's done right, it's really powerful.
Sure.
But it has to be done right. But they butcher it hard here. It's the most... It's like a lullaby version of God defend New Zealand.
It's like a D-tier anthem for me.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. I won't really argue with that. I mean,
if God save the Queen is, or King, rather, is like bottom tier. That is like F tier, whatever. God defend New Zealand is kind
it's
of
mid.
Dull.
It's mid.
Yeah, I'm not interested.
But La Marseillaise, however.
Ooh, hello.
It fires up. And S-tier. Suddenly you forget that you're in Cardiff all of a sudden. Thierry Doucetoir fully sending it, like really going for it. Embenez, much the same. Fabian Palouse giving it some beans. And you go, at that point, I'm like, oh my God, France can't lose this game. They're going to do it. They're going to do it. And then I remembered what came afterwards that then swung my opinion back to New Zealand winning this game.
Well, the hacker.
The hacker.
The hacker happens.
The hacker happens. As I say, this is one of the most important and famous bits of this game.
I had completely forgotten this hacker response.
I forgot this was this game.
Mm. So New Zealand set up to do the hacker in their grey kit. And France come immediately up to the halfway line.
They don't even go back in the first place.
No.
So it's not like in 2011 where they start on the 10-metre line and then walk up to halfway. They just start probably, I'd say, about 5 or 6 metres away from the furthest forward.
Not even that. Yeah. Not even that. There's like a yard or two between them.
Yeah. By the end, there are literal inches.
Yeah.
I love the setup of this as well. So France are on halfway. New Zealand are a couple of metres away from them. Sivuartu and Soruialu both trying to eyeball as many of the French players as humanly possible, just trying to really get in their heads. And I love directly, slap bang in the middle of the French line, looking over everybody, it's Sébastien Chabal.
Yes.
Chabal's role in this hacker is amazing.
So I had this thought, right, that this is the best French team they could have done it with. Maybe other than the 80s teams.
Yeah,
the 80s
team
right? You know, you could have
if
had...
they could have subbed in Eric Champ to stand next to Chabal.
Jean Condom.
Pascal Ondarts.
To just stand there and fight.
Pascal Ondarts would have nutted someone.
The problem is, they wouldn't have waited on halfway. They would have actually led in and bit the All Blacks doing the hacker.
So yeah, this is the best one.
This is the best one they could have done, right? Because if you go for like 2011, when obviously they have that great World Cup final against them, if they'd done that here... New Zealand would have been looking at them and it would have been so much less intimidating to look and be like, okay, yeah, they're facing us down, but it's David Skrella.
Yeah. it's Alexis Palace on.
Yeah, like, come on, lads.
Morgan Parra's way too good looking to pull this off.
Well, like, the only player that stands out where you're going like, oh, I'm not intimidated, is Vance Onclair. I would not be intimidated by Vance Onclair, but I'd look at him and be like, well, he's still good, isn't he? He's good at rugby.
Well, at one point, I like... slowed down the YouTube footage to go to half speed.
Yeah.
Just so I wanted to look at what the French players
were doing. Oh, you're watching a Squid Rugby video. He talks too quickly.
So, my notes as far as that goes, Chabal and Embenez both want a fight.
Yes.
Those guys are both actively looking out.
That's it.
Like, who can I fight?
You've got Chabal and you've got Ibanez. Like, the two hardest players who aren't likely to get themselves sent off before the game started.
Yes, exactly.
Peter de Villiers as well also counts for that. Like,
mate, Peter de Villiers so up for this.
Fabian Palouse and Jerome Fion.
Fabian Palouse, who is barely bound onto the person next to him because he's like, I need a free fist just in case. And also Fabian Palouse being the tallest along with Chabal, like, looking over his troops, his fort.
He's the tallest because Uruguay weren't.
It's true. It's true. They're not the tallest. Yeah. But my favourite was Yeno Boxes wasn't watching.
What?
Yeno Boxes was just looking into the crowd. He was just like looking into the higher tiers of the stadium because he couldn't be arsed with a hacker.
That's fantastic.
I love that man. But again, it gets in the head. If you're not interested in the hacker, yeah, it's literally happening 2 inches from you.
Yeah.
People would pay good money to have a hacker that is that close.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
They've got the best seat in the house. Yeah. And Yeno was instead looking for his mum.
I enjoy Clement Poitrineau is properly giving them eyeballs,
mm,
but not like in an evil sense, more in a like, I've heard of you.
Like he's at an art exhibition.
Yeah, 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 yeah. He's going like, oh, there's some interesting brush strokes there. Just trying to get his eyes in there, you know. Like apparently that's the best way to consume art, is you just get your like face straight in there, put like your eyes up so you get the individual brush strokes. He's doing that, but to like Jerry Collins' spies.
We've talked about France there, but the focal point of this hacker, as far as New Zealand are concerned, that made me think like, oh no, they are here, they're up for this. Ali Williams.
Yes.
A legendary hacker user. He is always known.
It's like him and Nonu.
One of, yeah.
Two who really stand out.
One of the goats at the hacker.
Yeah.
But at this point, there is genuine anger in his eyes that France have even dared consider challenge their hacker.
Mm.
To even consider challenging him in this game of rugby. And Ali Williams is great. He's a class act and plays very well in this game to get onto it.
Agreed.
But after that, when the hacker finally finishes and Byron Kelleher, he stands his ground. You know, he looks up at France and kind of has that look of what you're going to do. At which point, Sebastian Chabal squares up to him. Their foreheads touch, well, as close as could come with a guy who's 5 foot seven and a guy who's 6 foot five.
A Jake Ball Fafter Klerk situation.
Yeah. But Sebastian Chabal and Byron Kelleher, their faces literally touch. They make contact. And Chabal silently offers him for a fight in that moment. And that is just a great dramatic moment of the history of the Rugby World Cup.
The best thing is, right, Chabal goes back to sit on the bench after this.
Yes!
Like, the New Zealand players are there like, oh, Jesus Christ. Okay, we're fine. We're fine. That big scary caveman guy has gone away. Then when he comes back out, like, oh, God, we thought we got rid of him. we thought he went extinct years ago with the dinosaurs.
But it is great the way France just send him out and they just go, so you know how you're massive and you're not starting? Would you mind just taking all these guys on? And they just piss off for a little bit, you know, you can have a bit of a break. And then you need to do it all again. He's great. Sebastian Chabal's role in this is so good. I've really enjoyed Sebastian Chabal this World Cup. He's so much better than I thought he was.
Yeah. I think because we caught the tail end of his career watching.
Yeah.
And we missed the kind of peak Chabal
years. People call him overrated because he was a big star. But actually, he was bloody good.
He was.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
So the game kicks off.
Yes.
Joe Rockefoco makes an insane airborne turnover at one point, and it makes you realise that, oh, these breakdowns are going to be mental.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, so New Zealand win a turnover, like a minute or two in. And they look to spread it wide and France cover it. Cedric Caymans covers it. And then they turn the ball over again. And Ellisard clears. And it's a real statement because New Zealand have been scoring from those situations in every game so far. Every turnover ball, basically, this isn't a stat, But it feels like every turnover ball has resulted in New Zealand try, or at least like they get held up over the line. You know, yeah. At least get down there. Instead, they get it wide, they make no ground, they lose about a metre and the ball.
All it requires is one Julien Bonnaire.
Yeah.
And suddenly, as I say, New Zealand get slightly more limited than they would like.
Yeah, because we can start to get a sense over the first 5 minutes of this game how often France are kicking and how varied their kicking is. Because, as I mentioned, you know, they've got obviously Damien Traoré at fullback. They've got Boxis at 10, the most kicking-minded 10 they had available to them. They had Ellisard at 9, probably the most kicking-minded 9 they had available to them. And they also have David Marty at 13, who, really useful peg on him, you know, very capable kicker. Jozion, less of a kicker, but, you know, still perfectly
fine. Had an all-round rugby brain.
Though. And Cedric Haymond had a big boot on him.
Yes.
You know, he doesn't use
also
it in this game, really.
Also left foot as a kicker option as well.
Yeah, we don't really see it in this game.
No.
But he had a big boot on him if they needed it.
Yeah.
So they have a really kicking-oriented team, and they start to lean into that hard. The commentators, I don't know if you watch the English language commentators.
I use the one with the English guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They really start to speculate that they've got a ban on playing in their own half, especially in the first half.
Yeah.
And I think that could be the case, that they're kicking every time they're in their own half.
Yeah, I think at this point in rugby's kind of development with kicking tactics, I think that's entirely likely.
Yeah. So France are kicking everything, and I think they're kicking very smartly. They're looking for touch a lot, so there's no chance to counter.
Damien Try plays a few blinders on kick battles, like we see Ramos doing these days.
They do a lot of the old tactic that they outlawed pretty quickly after this, where you pass back into the 22 and they put it out in the full. France are looking for touch constantly. They don't want to give All Blacks attacking opportunities from deep. When they do, the interesting thing, and this does get brought up in commentary eventually, but like they do this quite a lot of the first half in particular, they kick to Sivavatu because they know he won't kick it back.
Yeah.
And they know if they can just put players on him, he will run it every time. And he doesn't really pass very often, and he doesn't kick at all. So you can exploit that.
Much like Vitboy, he often looks up and thinks, I'm going to have a crack.
Yeah. Here. And there's one point where he has a crack when he has like three players in front of him, one of them being Julien Bonnaire, who holds him up, and he gets turned over. That's in the second half, but it happens all the way through.
But that was also a pivotal moment in the game.
Yeah.
And they realise that, oh, they've got one weak link in their back line with a very specific aspect of the game.
Yeah.
And I don't think Sivavati kicks once in the whole game.
No. I don't think he kicked once in his whole career.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously, if you're that quick, in a sense, why would you?
Yeah.
But this game probably answers that question.
Yeah, exactly. And so you end up with this French team who are controlling territory.
Yeah.
Not possession, but territory.
Yeah. And quite early on, you get an indication of what France want to do, even if it doesn't quite work out, when they go for a drop goal setup.
Which is quite
ironic for reasons we'll get into.
We'll try hitting the drop goal rather than Boxis.
Yes.
When, obviously, if Yenel hit it, France would have won this game 23-18.
Indeed, they would have. But they go literally one phase where they crash up in midfield through David Marty. They have one short pod and they go straight back to the pocket, try and have a go from about 40-odd metres.
Yeah.
Extremely similar to the way England were playing in the 2023 World Cup against Argentina, that they would go for maybe two phases and then just quickly get back in the pocket and see what happens. They went through that, try misses the drop goal. But again, it's a good indication that France, as you say, they want to territorially control. And if they get that, there is a chance they play this game very differently.
I think it's a really smart way of playing this All Blacks team.
Agreed.
Right. They're defensively very sound. They've clearly put a lot of emphasis on that. You know, the Deuce Etoile thing comes up a lot, but they're really solid defensively. There are two breaks in the first half. Luke McAllister, in particular, makes some hitting angles between the two centres.
Yeah.
Other than that, they are really solid. They concede some meterage and some line breaks off first phase. If they stop you on first phase, they're basically sound from there on out.
Yeah.
That's the way it feels, you know? Which is kind of, you know, a very modern approach at the minute. You know, like Springboks are a bit like that. You know, there's club teams all over.
Or
like
at least if you're playing from an edge with a little bit of speed.
Sure, yeah.
But if you're in midfield, then they're going to be fine.
Yeah. I really like the way France play this opening stage.
Yeah, me too.
And they don't get any points out of it. But it's encouraging. And it feels like they've got amongst the All Blacks.
But
and the All Blacks
it does feel like they do keep down the amount of points that the All Blacks do score when they're in the ascendancy.
Yeah.
And once again, we'll get into it, but they should have scored more. But
that
is much more credit to France than I think it is down on New Zealand at this stage.
Well, there's one other big event in this opening quarter, right? Which is Serge Bettson goes in, makes a tackle, and completely blows his own head off, does not know where he is, can't stand up, looks all over.
He's unconscious.
He's unconscious. He's lying there on the ground. The doctor has to come in to check his like tongue's in the right place, and he's going to choke on his own tongue.
Puts him in a recovery position.
Yeah. They take it really seriously.
Yeah.
And
As does Wayne Barnes as referee.
Yeah. There's a conversation about whether he plays on. And I was begging to take him
it's
off.
It's horrible because I was really expecting that they would let him play
me
on.
Me too.
Because of what happened with Marius Tinku. Not Marius Tinku.
Lewis Moody. And Marius Tinku, though.
And Marius Tinku, yeah.
Both of them.
In the tournament earlier. It was really concerning. Yeah. But thankfully, he does go off.
Thankfully,
he hobbles off.
Yeah. Supported by two doctors.
Yeah.
But I was really concerned. And it does show that at least there was some care for concussion. If it was really bad, you know, if someone's unconscious, maybe they'll take them off. But it just shows how far we've come, you know, and how there is this generation of players that have really struggled with concussions. And it's been a big issue. This was happening to them regularly. Thankfully, now we are more aware of it. We are taking players off. And, you know, for all of Gregor Townsend being angry about it in the world, right? We prevented concussions and we were able to take people off and assess them properly.
It's very... You can't take too seriously.
No, exactly.
There's no such thing as too serious.
It's very, very reassuring to see how far we've come.
Yeah.
And every time there's one of these in these games and you expect him to talk,
my heart's
play
in my
on,
mouth, man.
Or like when the doctors themselves are asking if he can play on.
Yeah.
You
the fact that
realize how far we've come.
I can't help but think if the referees weren't Wayne Barnes and Tony Spreadbury, of course, Spread as being a qualified GP himself, and who the one who looked after Marius Tinku in that one where he was clearly concussed, and Spread has said, I don't care what your doctor and coach are telling me, you need to go off.
Yeah.
I can't help but feel like if those guys weren't the ones in charge, somebody would have let him play on if the doctors wanted him to. But again, like, thankfully.
You just mentioned him. Should we talk about Wayne Barnes for a moment?
We have to talk about Wayne Barnes for a moment.
So I had a moment watching this first half in which I thought to myself, Wayne Barnes is having such a good game.
Yeah.
And then I remembered the context around what this game is known for, one of those five key things you mentioned.
Yeah.
Wayne Barnes was 27 at this game, the youngest referee to ever referee a knockout game in the World Cup. He'd risen so quickly. They mention at the start on commentary, his ascent is maybe the greatest any referee ever had in terms of getting to having huge, huge games so early in his career. Obviously, refereed the World Cup final last year and retired afterwards. You know, this is the last game of rugby refereed. It's now gone. I think he refereed actually an age grade, like a local club game for his, you know, his local club.
The last professional game.
Last professional game. And yeah, has retired, for me, the greatest referee of all time.
Agreed.
I almost won't hear anyone else otherwise. I think he was the best. He was consistent. The way he adapted to the game as it changed. The way he refereed this game is very different to what he's refereeing in 2023. And yet you're seeing the same guy. He's so good at explaining his decisions.
Yeah.
There's a few where he makes a call and he then comes back and has to, you know, explain it to someone else. And so clear, so concise, so good at putting himself across. He just qualified as a barrister like a year before this, formally. Yeah, and I thought it was absolutely fantastic. And yet, the thing that comes up over and over again is that he wasn't experienced enough. He hadn't been around the block enough, and he couldn't do his job.
Anytime you listen to Wayne Barnes in an interview about his refereeing career, the thing he'll tell you is, I just love rugby. Yeah. And I just love the fact that I get to be on the same pitch as these world-class players, as Ardy Savir, as Dan Carter here, you know, as Fabian Palouse, as whoever.
Yeah.
That he is clearly so honoured and humbled by that and feels such a responsibility to get things right. So on our first series of this podcast, we covered the quarterfinal between South Africa and Australia, where Bryce Lawrence's refereeing performance has gone down in history as like one of the worst of all time. And basically we found it difficult to watch that game without having Lawrence under the microscope.
Yeah.
Without every single decision he makes going, is that correct? In a way that you wouldn't normally when you're watching a rugby game.
Yeah.
And because of the fact Wayne Barnes is still vilified by All Black fans for this game, and then for some stupid fucking reason also last year's final, because New Zealand lost it because they weren't as good as South Africa.
Yeah.
And people, you know, it's much easier to blame somebody else rather than taking responsibility. The team weren't as good. But anyway, because there is a decision that that comes up later, which they're correct to be mad about, right? To kind of preface it.
There's one incorrect call
in
this game.
Which is definitely incorrect.
And people say he should have gone to the TMO. We'll get onto this. That wasn't allowed at the time. That wasn't the protocols.
Yeah.
Right? If people are angry that Wayne Barnes lost the All Blacks this game, still, to this day, they are babies.
Yes.
They are children. Watch how badly New Zealand play in the last 20 minutes and tell me you lost the game because of New Zealand.
Yeah.
Because of the referee, rather.
Tell me that Wayne Barnes is the reason why
I couldn't even say because of Wayne Barnes, because of New Zealand. New Zealand lost this game themselves. Yeah. So the NZRU, spoiler, when New Zealand lose this game, they commissioned a full review into this occasion, into what happened, including into the referee and whether that cost them, right? The conclusion they came to was that it didn't. Obviously, one decision was costly, blah, 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 whatever. They came to the conclusion that the All Blacks coaches were unconcerned and comfortable when Barnes was appointed because of his earlier form in that tournament. They felt he was one of the best referees in the tournament of the pool stage and deserved the appointment, was the feeling of the All Blacks coaches before the game, right? Afterwards, after this, Graham Henry, in 2012, and this is the extraordinary bit, right? 2012, he published his autobiography after they win the World Cup in 2011. And this is a quote from his autobiography.
About I'm intrigued this game. About this.
We just got sawn off by the officials in that game, and that's the main reason we lost. The All Blacks didn't get a single penalty for the last 60 minutes of the game, which is not true, because they kick one after the 20th minute. And attacked over 70% of that time. Now that's impossible, but it wasn't impossible on that particular day. He said he felt it could have been, though he isn't sure, match fixing. Because they wanted the French to be in the later stage of the tournament.
Oh my good God. And the one decision that he gets wrong is pretty bad, right?
Yeah.
But you're right, I had the same feeling as you. I had the Bryce Lawrence effect here, where he's under the microscope, you look at every decision and go, oh, that's really interesting. But I very quickly forgot that this is the same game that he's vilified for. Because I'm like, oh, it's just Wayne Barnes.
I think he's really good.
Yeah, he's great. He doesn't really do anything else wrong. And sure, the one that he gets wrong is a bit of a blunder.
Yeah.
But you can't, again, like, if one incorrect refereeing decision is going to cost you a game, as happens in most games of rugby that come down to one score, then you should be further ahead.
The question that friend of the pod, Claire Thomas, asked Dan McFarlane, right, the cost of his job with Ulster, really, that, you know, when he was being really arsey with her in the post-match interview after they lost to a last-minute drop goal, and he was saying it was purely down to refereeing, and Claire asked him, well, shouldn't you be further ahead so that what can you do as a coach to make
prevent
sure
those situations? Yeah.
You're in a situation where one refereeing decision can cost you a game. One controversial rather than incorrect refereeing decision. And he went, well, you could say that about any game, you know, it's ridiculous. And got really shirty about
my case.
It. Yeah. And lost his job. And again, the talk I've heard is that it was more down to the interview than to the result.
Yeah. That just, it just inflates what is going wrong.
And it's the same thing with like Graham Henry here. Obviously, he keeps his job after this. That was a big, big debate in New Zealand. But the blaming of the referee is bullshit when your team lost this game.
Yeah. And we'll get into exactly how they lost the game. And we'll also, for balance, we'll talk about that one decision later on.
Yeah.
When usually we avoid that.
Because I say, the one decision is incorrect. Yeah. But you shouldn't be in a situation, especially if you're good at Team New Zealand, where that costs you the game single-handedly.
Do you want an observation about Wayne Barnes?
Yeah.
This is the most West Country he has ever been in this game. I think of Wayne Barnes, I hear him speak, and I think, he's just some nice, posh English lad. Whereas here, because he's got spreaders on the sideline with him, he's there just going like, that's carried back there as spreaders. And she's like, oh, wait, I forgot that Wayne Barnes is from, like, Gloucestershire.
But is he someone, does it just come out when he's speaking to someone else in the West Country?
I think that's it, though.
You know.
I think that's it. Suddenly, when spreaders is running touch for him, he's there going, oh, saw a tear then, lads.
Yeah.
But also, I think if I had a conversation with Tony Spreadbury, I'd probably start speaking in a Bristolian accent.
Yeah, it'd suddenly fall out of me. But yeah, so the one thing is, right, there was an article on stuff.nz, which is a really good piece on this World Cup in full, and they're very balanced and fair. But it does say, right, Barnes froze, especially in the final quarter. His decisiveness was replaced by terror. He just couldn't bring himself to make a call which would decide the match. He stood back and watched. I don't think that happens at all.
No.
I think all of that is bollocks, which has been built up since by people that remember a game from 15 years ago, rather than people actually watching it and going over his performance properly. People are going too critically over and looking over in a modern lens. In the context of how games were refereed in 2007, he's completely consistent. He's superb, especially in the way he's refereed in this tournament, which the All Blacks coaches were very happy with and encouraged about.
And had gone over and analysed in the meantime.
Yeah.
And so they knew about it. You can say, I think he was in a bit of a shit position to see that one forward pass.
Yeah.
And that's fine. It's a fair criticism.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll get on to all of
this. Anyway,
so back to the rugby. Yeno Boxis does a volley at one point.
Yes!
Which is great. Again, just going, oh yes, you're in this.
We have this two Luke McAllister breaks, which the first time he's in looked really on top.
He runs a bloody line and a half, doesn't he?
Both of them, he just picks angles last second. They're kind of things where I look at them, right, and there's another one that France run around the same time, where they just have Jojon come in and pick a line. And I was like, why don't teams try and run that nowadays? You know, oh, yeah, because the defense would smother you up because defense would actually advance on you.
Yeah.
But back then, when defenses stood back and they waited and they tried to make a decision, you could come in at the absolute last second, change your line, and completely split them, which McAllister does beautifully.
Yeah.
And he makes two breaks. The first one, he doesn't look for support. He doesn't look either side of him at all. And he's got Jerry Collins on his inside. And if he gives it, there's a decent chance that Collins makes it, or at least can get the pass back to him, or, you know, someone else wraps around. He doesn't even look up.
Yeah.
They lose the ball. He then managed to get another chance.
Dujshua smokes Collins, by the way, to win the ball back.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, he then makes another, and it results in a penalty, which Dan Carter knocks over.
Yes, 3-0 at that point.
Mm.
Yeah, I found with McAllister here, by the way,
mm.
whenever there was like, well, save for one moment later on, whenever it was like a big moment in the game, McAllister would come up on top and do something masterful. Whenever it was like something tiny, he'd do like something really shit.
Well,
there
yeah.
was that little chip kick he does in his own 22 really early on.
I was about to bring this up, yeah. So,
why?
This is the thing, that the All Blacks, they get this penalty in the back, and that seems to be their concept of playing sensible quarter-final knockout rugby, right? Is we'll kick one goal early on.
Yeah.
And so they then... they're going for chip kicks in their own 22. They go for a cross kick.
On the back
kick.
Foot as well.
Yeah. They go for a cross kick on their own try line at one point. In a World Cup quarter-final, when it isn't on, when they're under pressure, it's a play you go for if you're desperate to get the bonus point in the last play.
Mm.
Not, you know, you're going for... You're 3 points up in a quarterfinal.
That has 50 minutes to go in it.
Yeah. They're playing complete suicide rugby. They're trying offloads that aren't on. They throw one pass ridiculously forward in this first half. Another in the second half. And it just keeps building. They are playing the same way they played against Italy, against Romania, against Scotland. They play less seriously than against Scotland.
Yeah.
They play like this is an exhibition game. Like this is a game they're winning 61-12 like they did a few months earlier.
Yeah.
There is no regard for the situation, for the opposition, for the occasion, for the World Cup itself. They are playing like it's a competition that they've already won.
They're expecting that their big moment will come.
Yeah.
And then another one will come after that.
Yeah.
There's Ali Williams has that try chalked off early on.
Yes.
Where they go wide. It's a very just typical All Blacks of this era try.
Yeah.
It's not a try, but where it is, they're going through the hands. It doesn't matter whether it's forwards or backs, because they're all equally good at drawing players in. Mm. Ali Williams goes for a slide in the corner. His foot, unfortunately, is in touch, so it's ruled out.
Fantastic tackle by Ian Boxies.
Yes.
Clare gets across initially, manages to get in his way. Then Boxies finishes off and drags him over the line. Superb.
Yeah. Yeah, another of the McAllister moments comes up very, very shortly afterwards. And again, it does make you think, oh, there's a possibility that this could lead to something.
Yeah.
But McAllister runs a fantastic line off Dan Carter.
Yeah. Just hits the outside, changes the line last second. He looks like he's running a straight crash-up job, straight into Marty, then just like last second, like swerves slightly.
Like shuffles, yeah.
Yeah. Very, and suddenly very hits slightly. Like diagonally, straight between the two centres.
Yeah, and this time he learns from his mistake in the previous one, and he goes, oh, I've got Jerry Collins next to me. Mm. I might give him the ball. And so he does, and Jerry Collins has a great run, gets to up within sort of 5 or 6 metres of the line.
And offloads it back.
Yeah, nice little 1-2 between McAllister and Collins. And McAllister's dragged down just short, but manages to reach out and score it, using his momentum, sliding on a slightly greasy pitch in Cardiff. And it's a really nice try.
Yeah,
it's really beautiful. Aesthetically pleasing try to watch.
It's the thing the All Blacks were doing all through the pool stage.
Yeah.
And I think it is the moment that lulls them into that false sense of security. They've been tearing France up and it hasn't quite been clicking, and they've gone, okay, this is tougher than normal. It might be 30 points rather than 60.
Yeah.
And then that try comes and they go, cool, we were right. It just took some time to click, some time to break them down, and now we're doing that.
Yeah.
And they think we're 10-0 up, we're pulling away here.
Yeah, especially considering they'd already had the one chalked off as well.
Yeah.
And so, oh yeah, we can easily get through.
Yeah.
And McAllister made that clean break earlier. But this is pretty much all of the real estate they're going to see in this game. It's up to, what, that's maybe 23, 24 minutes in?
Yeah, yeah.
It's pretty early on.
France, meanwhile, from the kickoff, resort back to the tactic of booting literally everything.
Yeah.
And the crowd turn on them. The crowd stop booing France, which is kicking all the time. It's the most back and forth, like, what's going on? What's going on? Until eventually, right? I mean, so Damien Trihang's an absolutely brilliant bomb to trap New Zealand in.
Yeah, Kelleher drops it.
Yeah.
Because he comes onto the ball backwards whilst McDonald's at the back wanting to come onto it. Bit of confusion. Kelleher drops it forwards.
Yeah. And it's fantastic. New Zealand make another break.
Yeah.
And then right as they get onto the touchline, right as they get up towards the 22, Thierry Doucetois has what I think is the first big moment of his game.
Oh, mate. Talk to me about this.
Because he's been there. He's been making tackles quietly, you know. He, for the first half hour, plays like a good international standard flanker, right?
Yeah.
The important thing to know about Thierry Doucetois in this game is this is his eighth cap. For context, right, there is one back row forward in the Six Nations this year who currently has eight caps, right? And that's Luke Crosby. So
it is the equivalent of
if Luke Crosby suddenly put in one of the greatest performances you've ever seen from an international flanker.
Because I did have that moment that you're just alluding to where you go, oh yeah, Doucetois, he's like the unreal player in this game. And I was like, is it like conflated? Or is it one of those games where you watch it and then you go afterwards like, holy shit, Doucetois made loads of tackles.
Yeah.
But then you realise as the game goes on that it's slightly more towards what you thought it was.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then...
Oh, mate, talk me through this. This is so good.
So New Zealand just made this break down the short side, right? And I just about got back and covered it. I think, would it be try?
Yeah, made the tackle. Sivivartu, like, looks... There is a world in which Sivivartu scores there.
Sure,
He's been scoring in this tournament.
Yeah. Doucetois leaps in from absolutely nowhere.
He's not even on screen.
No, he suddenly just, like, warps onto the... onto the pitch, onto the shot, and into the ruck. And you just kind of see this scrum cap ferreting about down there and suddenly turns around with the ball.
Like, I saw the ball come through, out of the French side, and I was like,
yeah.
What happened there? Was that a knock-on or something? And I went back and watched it again. And, oh my God, Doucetois straight in and out.
Yeah.
There. Because often when someone gets in that position, they cling on to the ball and like see if they can get the penalty out of it.
Yeah.
But instead, he knows that's not going to happen, just chucks it through his legs.
Yeah.
And it's just the quickest turnover I've ever seen.
And it's the only time France run it in this first half. So they try to run from deep, and they get right the way down, and then there's a high tackle given against them, which I greatly enjoy. Jonathan Kaplan on touch comes across to give it, and you can hear a shout from the crowd of, no shit, Kaplan! Which is great, because it is a very obvious high tackle. But it is the first moment of Doucetois standing up, really, because up until then, he's been quietly making his tackles, and he's probably by this point made, like, 7 or 8. You know, that's a solid number.
At the start, you can kind of tell that he's targeting Jerry Collins a little bit as the All Blacks' main ball carrier. There's a really good bit of line speed he does to chop Jerry Collins in the attacking position. He then gives away a penalty, though. So Carter kicks it, 13-0.
I was almost prepared for a really hipster take on this podcast, right, where the commentator... When that turnover's made, the assistant commentator goes, oh, brilliant turnover by Bonaire. And I went, wait, is it Bonaire in 7 in the scrum cap? Then I was like, oh, cool. Okay, so I've got a hipster take now. I've got a really alternative take that Bonaire was better than Doucetois in this game.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then I watched it for a minute longer and I was like, no, that's that guy's black. Like, that's not Julien Bonaire. That is Doucetois. No, Doucetois was as good as Doucetois was in this game. Doucetois was better than Thierry Doucetois.
One of my favourite moments was when... After that penalty, France take the kickoff, and Keith Robinson's got like a lifting pod ready to send him up to take the kickoff. And Jerome Thion, just being a tall twat, just like waves his hand in Keith Robinson's face to get in the eye line. And the ball just bounces, at which point Byron Kelleher goes, shit, leaps for the ball, at which point Doucetois just absolutely creams him.
Yes.
And then they have like a really hard time exiting the 22.
I think that's the second big Doucetois moment
that
comes up. Because we might as well just talk about it, right? Thierry Doucetois in this game makes 38 tackles.
Yeah, he does.
The standing world record for most tackles in an international rugby match.
And am I right in thinking that as of the 2011 final, he was the second to himself on the most tackles made in a Rugby World Cup game?
No, that was something like 25. Like, there are other players who've hit 30.
Okay.
There's not many, but like 30 is an unbelievable number in international rugby.
I believe to this day, as far as I can remember, I looked this up the other day.
Mm.
That is joint with Peter Steftatoy in the World Cup final last year, where he's man of the match and so on. That is the second most tackles anyone has ever made in a Rugby World Cup individual match. Can you guess what the first is?
Tell me.
It's on a game we've covered on this podcast.
Oh, God, no. It's thingy, isn't it? It's Rakaroi?
It's Colly
Rakaroi against New Zealand.
In the game where they weren't trying.
Where he said he wasn't trying at full time.
Yes. That is the most tackles.
No, that's most turnovers of all time, wasn't it?
Oh, was it? I think it might also be most tackles, though. I think he made one more tackle than Doucetois did in this game. which is really funny because him and Fiji weren't trying in that game. I love how often that game comes up, by the way.
It really is. Yeah, really. No, Deuce Twas is still standing as the most tackles in a World Cup match.
Okay, okay.
Peter Steph de Toy made 28 in the World Cup final last year, and it was 38 by Deuce Twas.
Oh, bloody hell.
So, yeah. And de Toy was unreal in that World Cup final.
That's one of the best individual performances in a World Cup final ever.
Yeah.
And yet, here we are.
10 behind it.
So, Thierry Dusautoir's played pretty bloody amazing. This is maybe the second best game I've ever seen him play on games we've covered on this podcast.
I'd agree with that. Yeah, I think he's better in the 2011 final
than this. Which is just funny. That's just... I'm not saying that to put him down. I think of all of the games we've done on the podcast, I think Dusautoir in the 2011 final is probably the best individual performance I've seen.
Yeah, I think so.
But that's obviously relative because, you know, bloody Berrick Barnes against Wales scoring 90 points against them because they're shit doesn't really count.
Sure. And also, in order to play to that level in 2011, you've got to play to a lower standard than you would nowadays.
It's all relative.
Relative to what was going on, I think Deuce Twal was the best performance I've ever seen from rugby player in 2011. I think this is extremely good.
It's not far off.
Yeah. He's a very, very good rugby player. I was thinking about this, right? Does he have the highest ceiling of any flanker of all time? Because you'd say Richie McCaw is a better player, right? Mm. David Pocock, perhaps.
Yeah.
You know, a few of those players in the modern era, George Smith, all come up. But I think if you were to put the three best games he ever played in their life, Dusautoir against any other flanker of all time, I think Dusautoir clears them.
He wipes the floor.
Yeah.
I can't think of another player. As I say, maybe Du Toit in the final last year. If Peter Steph Du Toit is probably the closest in terms of the absolute ceiling.
Yeah, in terms of how good he can possibly be.
Yeah.
I think him in the two World Cup final he's played in.
Yeah, that's a great question.
The closest I've seen someone come since Dusautoir. I think that's a really good question. I think those probably are the two. I don't know who the third member of that kind of holy trio is.
I can't think of anyone who's near those two.
No. Players in general as well, beyond just...
Yeah.
Just flankers?
Just back rows just happen to be the most involved a lot of the time, especially in these kind of games.
If I was to think of the best performance I've ever seen from any players, they're normally tens or they're back rowers.
Yeah. I can't wait to talk about Man of the Match later after this.
I know, yeah. But okay, yeah, no, I'll save some of it back when we do that.
If he's in contention, he might not be. There's a long time to go with this game left.
Yeah, New Zealand go for a cross kick on their own try line, and they just about recover it, almost losing it. They bat it back to Jerry Collins, who clears it himself.
Yes,
in the ultimate moment of fiddim.
Yeah, and that's Jerry Collins' second kick of the game as well, because he did a little grubber kick, which Yearnell volleyed. Yeah, I love that from Jerry Collins. I love that he clearly actually thought of himself as one of the best kicking options in the team, which is just funny. I love
France,
Jerry Collins.
Run it back. Mm. They get a penalty. They kick it to go to halftime, 13 points to 3.
LSR does also miss one next to the post.
Of course,
as well.
Well, Boxies misses one and LSR misses one.
Yeah. Also, that last penalty, I've got to say this, for as brilliantly as he's playing, we've not really talked about it that much so far. Ali Williams, needlessly comes in the side of a maul, 40 minutes in, on as the clock is read, 45 meters out. All you need to do is do one defensive set and kick the ball out. Yeah. And he needlessly just takes a shortcut, comes in the side of a maul, gets pinged for it, 3 points down all of a sudden. It's really stupid. For balance,
His... Both his superpower and his Achilles heel was that he was a massive cunt.
Yes, exactly. And he's being such a cunt in this game.
And that's why he was as good as he was. Right?
Unbelievable.
He's one of the best cunts. Not biggest cunts, best.
Yeah, both.
You'll see.
He's both. But and yet he's so good in this game.
Bite him on the arse.
He's superpower level player in this game. He's just going around, he's hitting every ruck, he's smashing people, he's making proper bastard carries where he just makes 3 more meters than he is meant to. He's going around, he's just having a proper Etzebeth of a game, going around and just going, who can I piss off next? And it's like, dude, bro, just get tired, please. Jesus Christ, just get tired, have a fucking lie down. But instead he's just going, no, I need, I have more spite in me, I need to piss more people off. And I love watching second rows have those games. It's one of the best sights in rugby.
Yeah.
Talk about the highest ceiling of players. The highest ceiling of any position in rugby is second rows because they can emotionally taunt you better than any other position in the sport. And Ali Williams is doing that all game. He's so in everyone's head.
Absolutely. So, we get to half-time.
Yes, we do.
New Zealand are 10 points ahead.
Yeah.
which is a smaller lead than they probably expected,
yeah.
But a bigger lead than I expected from, yeah. You know.
And probably, again, a smaller lead than they perhaps deserved.
Sure,
that
yeah.
They could have scored more tries, they could have finished more chances.
Yeah, yeah.
France could have not defended as well. It's yeah. My way of paraphrasing that.
Yeah. Straight from the kickoff, right? We have a bunch of bloody rugby breaks out. I don't know what that's all about. Then New Zealand ended up with a scrum on about halfway. And we start to see, I think, a big theme of this second half begins immediately from that first set piece of the second half. So
BK.
Of the...
Burger King, Byron Kelleher.
Yeah. Byron Kelleher picks up at the back of the scrum, goes, tasty burger. Here's a discount or whatever. I haven't been into Burger King since I was like 12.
Yeah, you're a vegetarian.
Yeah. So Kelleher breaks off the scrum, goes a little dart himself. Again, the space in behind, like the fullback comes up really close. No interest in kicking, no interest in passing. Goes himself, his ankle goes from under him, and he's kind of hobbling back, and he's clearly unwell. He shouldn't be playing on, but New Zealand decide to keep him on, right? They have made a poor game management decision. They've tried to force the play when it wasn't on. It's sort of them losing the ball because he bloody knocks it on. And they've got a player...
McAllister passes into touch as well.
That's it, sorry, yeah. McAllister passes into touch, and his ankle's gone. And they've got an injury to one of their key players. Those are the key themes of the half. Bad game management, overplaying, and injuries to key players.
And Luke McAllister passing the ball into touch. That's also one
of
them.
And Luke McAllister being stupid, yeah. So, yeah, then, like... We've got, I mean, I've got no idea what happens next, but my next note is just Marty plus Jozion, great.
I have
that goes for
down,
a lot of it.
Ducetoir bangs Woodcock, McAllister dumb grubber.
I mean, Jesus, was that after the game?
Yes.
But, yeah.
It was a hell of a performance.
But yeah, so there's a long passage of French defence. I think it's a big start of it. They have one near the end of the first half where they're picking and going constantly and nothing comes of it.
Yeah.
And they have another one at the start of the second half, which goes on even longer. And eventually... There's a loose ball, and Heymans just, like, hacks it up, and they are suddenly getting on top.
Yeah. They get to within sort of 10 metres of the line because of Heymans' massive boot. I think Elissard helped him out as well. And the commentator saw this as, like, a big controversial point where Heymans, instead of towing it along the floor to potentially transmit the try, bends down to pick it up, which obviously allows the All Blacks to catch up. I think it's not the wrong decision by Heymans.
I don't think it's the wrong decision, no.
Yeah.
I don't think he had the out-and-out pace to beat the cover coming across.
Yeah, like, Rakovaku's
fast.
Yeah.
He's fast as well, but I don't think it's a surefire thing, whereas I'm having possession in the 22 is happening here if he does pick it up.
Yeah.
And he picks up without having to break stride much. Like, it's not like he bends down, slows down to pick it up.
So talented, isn't he?
He's really good.
This I love watching this guy play.
2 years before his infamous try, the thing he's best remembered for, his winning try in New Zealand against New Zealand, which obviously granted is a bit of tribute to Van Sinclair,
yes,
who wasn't playing.
Vincent Clerk. Actually.
Vincent Clerk, sorry, you know. Vincent Clerk.
Yes, that's funny. But France stay down this end of the field for quite a long time.
They lose the ball, but they manage to put pressure on the clearance over and over.
They make Kelleher and then soon Leonard really struggle to get out of their territory because they're trying to take a maul with Carter carrying his injury until eventually they clear up to about the 22 and France go for a maul.
Yes.
They go, Fabien Palouse, good luck to you. We'll put a load of big men around you and we'll see what happens.
And this is the start of France really leaning into another tactic that'll come good for them, which is just... We've got eight, like, absolutely massive guys. Have you seen how big these, like, lads are? Should we just, like, get them to, like, shove the All Blacks? Because, like, their lads are pretty big, but they're not as big as our lads. Our lads are, like, bastards.
It's great, isn't it, when they finally lean into that?
Yeah.
The thing is, they had the same realisation against Argentina at the start of the tournament.
Yeah.
And it still took them 40 minutes to realise, like, oh, they are quite big, aren't they?
It's that eternal French debate between, like, beauty and brutality.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, we should try and be beautiful, shouldn't we? We're at home. And they're like, wait, no. Let's just beat these pricks up.
That maul is a beautiful
thing really
to watch,
is.
Isn't
it? Really it really is.
That it requires, I don't know who does it, but a very well-timed professional foul by the All Blacks to stop it.
Yeah.
To make it a penalty advantage. So,
it goes down, like, a yard or two short.
Yeah.
Like, I think there's a lot of referees that would have gone straight into the sticks and given the penalty try.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if we're to talk about Wayne Barnes freezing, maybe that's the moment rather than any of the
indeed,
others.
Indeed. Yenel goes for a speculative chip, which I'm so here for, on penalty advantage.
Yeah.
Jozion is taken out off the ball.
Very clearly by McCarthy, who steps into him and shoulders him very clearly.
Yeah, which means that the ball is fielded in goal simultaneously by Leo McDonald and
Mills Maeda. It's cute, isn't it? Like, yeah, like a ship it.
Yeah.
And Wayne Barnes, I think, really well, you know, talks to his touchers like, do you think that's a little bit taken out? Toucher says yes. And he then calls over the New Zealand captain, Richie McCaw, and Luke McAllister. So we've had one professional foul there, we've had one professional foul here. Either of them could be yellow cards. I'm going to give one to McAllister.
That is an inspired piece of reffing, I think.
Yeah.
Instead of it being, okay, that's the first professional foul. If you do it again,
yeah,
then you're going to have a man in the bin. He's gone. No, that's a trend. Yeah. There's been two in the same passage of play. I know, like, I can tell from that 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 is the way that they want to defend in their own 22, and I'm not fucking standing for that. Like, that's a really good just piece of discipline by Wayne Barnes.
Yeah, yeah. I saw, again, in looking up stuff around this game, a article on a Kiwi website complaining about that yellow card, saying it's harsh, it came out of nowhere, it's the first part, whatever.
It's smart by McAllister, man, and he goes to the bin for it.
Yeah, two players gave away potentially try-saving penalties against them, right?
It's a sacrifice.
Whenever you do that, you know you're taking the risk of a yellow card in order to try and prevent a try. They did that twice in a row in the space of about 30 seconds, and Barnes calls their bluff.
I stand by McAllister's decision to do that, because I think a lot of referees would not give that.
Sure, especially in 2007.
Exactly. A lot of them would just give them the benefit of the doubt and say, don't do that again.
TMO couldn't step in.
Exactly. Yeah. I think a lot of referees would just give him a warning for that. And don't get me wrong, the outcome very much is not in his favour. That's the one big moment I was saying that is not good by McAllister.
Mm. Well, I mean, there's a couple more.
Sure. But that's where it starts to go downhill,
I think.
As I say, there's a lot of small moments that go horribly wrong for him that accumulate. Mm. Like, that's not me saying Luke McAllister plays really well. He does a few things really well that are extremely significant.
Sure.
But yeah, my point is I completely see why he does that on Jozyon. Because it saves a try and he goes to the bin for it on something that's...
I still don't think it was that threatening a chip. I still don't think Jozyon was going to beat...
man.
That's true.
You are right, though. They did have two fullbacks back then.
Yeah, I don't think it was necessary. Mm. I think if it was one-on-one...
Which is valid. Maybe. Yeah. Yeah, I guess.
But
so.
I think that is covered, and I think that's a daft decision.
No, you've got a good point. I think doing a professional foul there is a good decision rather than that professional foul.
Sure.
So, fair point.
So, France end up. Here they are. They've got the penalty.
They kick it, 13-6.
Yep. Now, they're suddenly back within seven out of nowhere.
Game. Turning point.
And they have 10 minutes for man in the bin.
Yes. It's so weird because straight after this, New Zealand seem to be back in their mojo, just very, very briefly. Yeah. Like, Mulyana makes that half break and you go like, oh, this is threatening. This is dangerous. Yeah. And then New Zealand reach this point where every time they do an attack, instead of doing what's worked for them, they just go for pick and goes.
Pick and goes, constantly. Yeah.
Why is this? They're playing this as a bigger pack. They do make ground off it because no one knew how to defend pick and goes back then.
So Richie McCaw talked about this in autobiography, right?
Okay.
This was the All Blacks' plan B. And this comes up again later. Their plan B was that they pick and go constantly in order to eke out penalties.
Mm.
And they figured that was the trend at the time in refereeing, was that they would give advantage to the attacking team very much every time.
So they could gamble.
So, yeah. So they would look for penalties to gamble or to make ground downfield.
I do see the rationale.
Yeah. That was kind of part of their strategy, was assuming that they'll reward the attacking team, right? And Wayne Barnes doesn't do that.
Yeah.
I haven't looked back over his games from this tournament to know whether he's doing that in the pool stage or not. But Wayne Barnes is not giving them any leeway. And so the All Blacks are going for this completely wasteful strategy that isn't what's been working for them the entire tournament, isn't what's been working for them this game. And yet they go at one stage 20-plus phases, working down from about 30 metres to the 5 metres out, just through picking and going. And there's one ruck where Jerry Collins takes like 40 seconds over the ball, just waiting there for almost a full minute to pick and go.
It's fascinating because, as I say, at this point, defence coaches hadn't really drilled in how do we dominate a pick-and-go defensively.
Sure, yeah.
Like, how do we push people back? So on every pick-and-go, New Zealand are making ground. They're making probably 1 or 2 metres on every pick-and-go they do. However, against this French back row, bearing in mind Serge Betson's gone off and they've got Aaron Aldekey in, who's a bastard over the ball, like really difficult to shift. And there is a very specific Aaron Aldekey turnover later on that we'll come on to. But you're multiplying the amount of rucks that you're going through and the amount of opportunities that Bonaire, Doucetois, and Aaron Aldicchi are having to steal that ball. And those are not the only breakdown threats they have, because they've got Sebastian Chabal, who steals one off a pick-and-go sequence at a key point in the game when New Zealand are really close to the try line. They've got, like, Imbeneza is actually pretty good over the ball. Peter de Villiers is, like, weirdly quite mobile in defence.
But, like, this long 20-plus phase sequence ended them popping it 5 metres out from the try line to Rodney Sauiolo.
Yes.
Who just knocks it on cold. Just sees Elisard fly up in his face. The scrum off, the smallest player in the French team, flies up in his face and he knocks it on cold.
Yeah.
And France clear it.
Yeah. And suddenly that period of pressure's over. And that's where you start to think, like, oh, France could win this.
From the scrum, New Zealand early engage. Right, so they give them a really easy out from this. They clear up to halfway and they just keep working down and down. Right, France bring on at that moment Chabal and Soseski, who I think are brilliant changes.
Yes.
Both of them bring A, hair, and B, dynamism, enthusiasm,
energy.
Chaos, energy being the key word. Both of them are really charged up, fired up. They are inspired kind of impact subs because they lift the entire team around them.
And the crowd as well are so into those guys coming on. Yeah. It's, as you say, it's inspired. It's great timing, just as the All Blacks have blown a chance.
Yeah. Are they as good as the players they're coming on for? Who gives a shit? They've changed the way this France team feel.
Yeah. So New Zealand still have the ball from the 22 dropout or clearance rather that France put in. They go through a few phases and Dan Carter goes for a long range drop goal attempt.
Yeah.
Which goes very wide.
Yeah. Which is interesting, because again, New Zealand have talked since, and this becomes more and more relevant as the game goes on, they didn't have a set drop goal drill.
Yeah.
So Carter's made a snap decision there. The crowd boos him for it, but he's gone, we're uncomfortable here, we need some more points on the board, and goes for a snap drop goal.
Retrospective shit.
Yeah.
He does the same in 2015 twice, and it wins them the World Cup.
Yeah.
Because they had a plan set around that.
Yeah.
Or at least, if it doesn't come off, what's our plan B?
Yeah.
And this fucking backfires.
Yeah.
The decision to not even necessarily just Carter's decision. Carter's decision does backfire, but the fact that they didn't have any consideration of what that would mean is what especially backfires.
There's no one chasing this. There's no one following up.
No. So you...
Carter, I think, is the furthest back player on the All Black team. So no one can chase because he doesn't.
Yeah.
Because no one chases their own drop goal.
You can't chase a drop goal because it would compromise your technique.
Yeah.
You know? You see a replay of that Carter drop goal miss, and then you hear Wayne Barnes going, Jouer! In the background.
Yes.
And the camera cuts back, and France have taken the 22 drop up quickly, unopposed.
Yeah. Because no one was following up, and they're now breaking downfield. They're up, coming up towards halfway by the time the camera cuts back, like a second later.
And it's worth saying, when you take a penalty, nobody really takes those 22s quickly off that.
No.
Because if you do, it's because somebody's very clearly not marked an area.
Yeah, yeah.
Then, you know, you can
or
work.
Or you're England
it.
In that quarterfinal last week.
Sure, sure. But off a drop goal, you kind of have to figure out where roughly you would stand afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. Where but, instead, here, there's nothing.
Yeah.
And France get up to halfway, and then they just keep pushing on.
Jouer, they do.
Yeah.
Amon runs down the wing. David Marty has a really nice touch in here.
Yeah.
And Vincent Clerc hits an absolute beauty of a line in midfield. And the best bit about this, I really love the way he kind of contorts his body to get that ball away. Because if you see a winger hit that line, you think they're going for the try line. But instead, he lifts the ball straight up onto the outside for Aaron Aldicchi, isn't it?
Aaron Aldicchi on the far extreme, yeah.
And Aaron Aldicchi has a big run down the wing.
Aaron Aldicchi should score this. Anyone in that situation, unless you're a tighter prop, should score this.
Yeah.
He is unopposed. He's got 22 metres to go. There's no one within 10 metres of him any direction. No one in front of him.
I don't think he ever cared about being fast, is the thing.
No, no. I'd say he slows down, but he doesn't get up to speed in the first place. So eventually he rides to tackle and he stays in touch. He doesn't go for the dive in the corner, which I appreciate.
He's the best slow rugby player of all time, isn't he?
All props would argue with you.
Yeah, that's true.
But, yeah, he managed to recycle a ball. They're within 5 metres and France go wide out one way. They go right up to the far touchline and David Marty almost squeezes through himself.
Yeah. Jojon has a carry out wide as well.
Yeah.
But then what really impresses me, to use today's rugby terms, is how quickly France reload.
Yeah.
Once a ruck has been completed and the scrum half's played it away onto the left-hand side, everyone reloads, including Jojon, who I just mentioned, and gets into a realistic position and goes, right, what can we set up for the next phase? And they use the whole width of the field to set an attack.
It's completely accidental, right? But they go back this way, and they have so many runners in position, so many runners on their feet, that when they hit Doucetoir, he has people out his back on either side. People in New Zealand defence have got to be watching from all angles.
Like a flat option and deep option on both sides, yeah.
Doucetoir is able to like wiggle between two players, just hit that line and go over to score the try. The third big Doucetoir moment.
Yes.
Right. The thing about that is what they've accidentally done, completely accidentally, not in a way that's repeatable because no one would have noticed, is they've accidentally invented Andy Farrell's island attack.
Yeah, they have. As I say, it's how quickly they reload.
Yeah.
It's you get back onto your feet and you go, right, where do you need me next, lads?
Aaron Aldicke makes that massive carry down the touchline. Everyone goes in to clear out because it's first phase and he's trying to disrupt it. So they have like five forwards in that ruck. The next phase afterwards, you know, they've got all the forwards are located in that area. They go back that way. All the forwards are in the same zone, but the defence is spread out more evenly. So they're able to attack and completely overload one area of the pitch by going back there repeatedly. It's like, it's exactly the philosophy that really works for Andy Farrell. It's a, you know, more and more common in rugby league as well. You love rugby league. You'd know
about
that. Yeah. You'd love rugby league.
But as well as that, so Aaron Aldicke's on the wing. Mm. He gets tackled and then he stays there afterwards as an edge forward.
Yeah, yeah.
Which obviously edge forwards didn't exist at that point because an edge forward. Meaning...
Except for Tom Croft.
Yes.
Tom Croft was the only one.
And Rocky Elson.
But, yeah.
Meaning at that point, Jozion then goes in and fills in as an auxiliary fly half. And Vance Sinclair goes in and fills in as a forward.
Yeah.
Because he's meant to be on that right wing. But instead, Aaron Aldicke's there. So what can I do? How can I use my body more efficiently? I'll go and handle the ball and run a line off Jozion. Mm. Which he does. And he's the one who gives the pass, this try-scoring pass to Doucetoir.
If I was in a situation trying to work out how to use my body more efficiently, I'd just sell my organs. But no, he decides, what I'm going to do is I'm going to, hang about. They just create so much doubt for the New Zealand defence.
Yeah.
And they, as I say, like accidentally invent all the modern attacking terms.
Yeah.
And it allows Doucetoir to dive through. And like, Doucetoir has this air, the moment he gets the ball, of no one is going to touch him.
Yeah.
He gets that ball and he's like, he's going to score.
He doesn't make any facial expression.
He's like air in this game, the kind of feeling around Thierry Doucetoir in this match. It's like, do you remember Mario Strikers on the Wii?
Yeah, of course I do.
Where you would pick like one proper Mario character to be like Mario, Luigi, Wario, Princess Peach, whoever. Right. And the rest of your team were all like Shy Guys or like Coopers or whatever. You know, it kind of feels like that, this French team. Because this French team aren't great.
No.
But they have one outstanding player. And it feels like Doucetoir's like Mario Luigi. And like all the other French players like Cooper Troopers. They're just like helping him out. And they're the little like toads. They're just on this doing like the rest of the grunt work around it.
Like, big up Jerome Thion. He is definitely a Cooper Trooper type guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Going around the pitch and just like AI generated mopping up all the mess, fucking people up in lineouts.
Then you've got Shabal in goal as the Kremlin, the crocodile guy.
By the way, something that we've not really mentioned is quite how much France have them at the lineout.
Yeah.
They're not stealing any ball, but they're going up every time and New Zealand having to slap back every single ball.
Yeah, good point.
So Kelleher is really struggling and then Leonard when he comes on because constantly they're chucking up to Ali Williams at home. Mm. He's doing a great job to actually get a mitt on the ball.
Yeah.
But every single time he can't win it cleanly because Jerome Thion's just going up every single time. I think he's so good here, Jerome Thion. Mm. He's a player that I've always really underappreciated because he's like a really unsexy lock. And when I say that, I know that all locks are meant to be unsexy in ways that were described earlier. But like, you look at like Franco Mostert, the amount of unsexiness that he does on the pitch, where he just like hits breakdowns, kills people in tackles, all of that,
actual murders.
Yeah, like that's almost become sexy, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas Jerome Thion would just do whatever it is that's invisible to the human eye beautifully. He was so good, so underappreciated because he played with Palouse and then Nalle, and Pape, and Pierre and Shabal. Like he played with really good other locks, but he formed some very good partnerships in his career. Really, really great lock.
Yeah, absolutely. So Doucetoir goes over.
Yes,
scores. The conversion comes off the post. It's ugly as all hell. I thought he had missed, but
I
no.
Thought so yeah,
it goes between. And it brings the scores to 13-all as McAllister comes back on from the naughty step, going, "Oh, what happened? When I went off, we were 10 points ahead. What's happened?"
New Zealand and the fans and so on at that point are thinking, "Shit, right?" Mm. And then, just to accentuate things, just to really pile it on for them, the camera cuts to the limping Daniel William Carter.
Yeah. who goes and sits down on the sideline, and on comes Nick Evans.
Yeah. Hell of a replacement to have.
Yep.
But if you're at 13 all and you have the option of having Dan Carter, you'd kind of like it.
Yeah. But also, right, Nick Evans was not a guy who had a lot of big game time.
Certainly not international level.
This was the last of his 16 caps.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is mad to think. Yeah. Because you think of him as the ultimate experienced fly-off who closed out games for you. But as you say, that all came after this.
Do you want to know the other great fact?
Go on.
This is the only game of his test career that Nick Evans lost.
No. In a way, though, that's a good thing to bring on.
Yeah.
Is somebody who doesn't know how to lose.
Yeah.
But given how cagey the atmosphere of this whole game is, and like Carter goes off and he's immediately in tears.
Yeah.
Like
the
shot of Carter in tears, I thought was at full time. But it turns out, I mean, there is a shot of Carter in tears at full time. But there's two famous shots of Carter in tears. And one of them is as soon as he goes off injured. And I didn't realise that.
Yeah. But the interesting thing about Nick Evans, right, is that he's been generally getting like 5-10 minutes off the bench when the game's already won, you know, and Carter's done his job and he can go for a lie down. He hasn't been in this situation where he's supposed to manage these tight games. And you look at most of his caps, right? He had one against Springboks, one against Australia. But generally, they were against teams that New Zealand were beating pretty comfortably.
Yeah.
And he was then coming on the Pacific Islanders, Ireland at the time, Wales at the time, Portugal, Romania, Scotland. You know, there's literally two tight games in his entire test career before this.
Yeah.
No, one tight game, actually, because that South Africa game, they won comfortably. So he played in one tight test match before this. And he's thrust into this environment 13-all.
Yeah,
when he comes on, the most important game.
It's a big ask
of and the All Black calendar.
Pretty much the first passage of play that he's on, there's this long pick and go sequence again around the 22, and you can physically see the All Blacks trying to figure out how to set a drop goal.
Yeah,
now you can physically see them going like, "What do we do here? What is the protocol?
Yeah.
Do we attack, or are we meant to try and figure out how to set a drop goal? And they just can't do it.
They
try and go wide, and it doesn't work.
Is the play after Carter goes off? Kelleher's leg pulls up on him again, and Leonard comes on. So in the space of a minute, they lose both their halfbacks, and not through choice. They lose both of them, replaced by Ospreys legend Brendan Leonard, who probably tried to lead the revolution after this game as well, because that was just what he did. You know, when he was waving his flags and starting revolutions, bald on bald crime, because he tried to overthrow Steve Tandy's the joke here. When he's at the Ospreys, he tried to overthrow Steve Tandy. France also started to get really on top of the scrum here.
They
at first, they're not getting reward because it's on New Zealand ball and they managed to get the ball out quickly enough. But you can see the scrum battle has swung and changed. And New Zealand forwards are tiring, which is another interesting point actually around this. So in the lead-up, in the Super Rugby season before this, the 2007 Super Rugby season, the NZRU had struck a deal with not just the clubs, with the franchises in Super Rugby, but with the union as well, the players' union, and with Sky, the broadcaster, to take the 22 frontline All Blacks out of the running, out of Super Rugby for the first 6 rounds of the competition.
Okay.
In order to purely work on fitness.
Oh.
For this tournament. So, what it led to, right, was an awful lot of All Blacks being really annoyed that they weren't playing. And apparently, it just didn't work at all. So, one of the things that Graham Henry talked about in his autobiography afterwards was that he felt they weren't fit enough for this game.
Okay.
And he thought part of that was, you know, they took 22 players out. If you're taking the full squad out, maybe they could have worked on fitness differently. But also, those players themselves have all said it was a terrible idea and they hated it.
Yeah.
Because they were just doing fitness training, right? This was in February. The World Cup was in September. That isn't how conditioning works.
It takes those 1 week for your fitness to drop off.
Yeah. Those players then went back to their clubs and went back to their old training regimes.
Yeah.
So they weren't getting the fitness rewards by the time the World Cup rolled around. What they've done is they've been absolutely beasted and went into a full season.
May.
Played, well, they missed the first 5 rounds, then played most of the season, played the test season, played the World Cup pool stages, and then came in tighter than they would have otherwise because they're doing more intense fitness than they would have
at
done.
At the start, yeah.
At the start of the season. They done the pre-season with their club, then went into a, like, extreme preseason with the All Blacks, and then into playing.
Also, mentally, that must fuck you up.
Yeah.
Like, well, really burn you out.
Yeah. I think it was Baron Keller who said, like, just mentally hated it. Like, he hated sitting on the sideline every week, not being able to play, you know, just doing all this training with no reward in sight when he was seeing his team go out and lose and, you know, couldn't do anything about it.
Man alive.
He wasn't even a part of the teams.
That
felt very separate.
Very poorly, didn't it?
So, yeah, if fitness is a contender, and I think it's one of these things, right, that you talk to coaches nowadays, it's one of the things that starts to come up in coaching more and more often, is the decision-making that players have under fatigue. And it's something Razzie Erasmus put enormous pressure on, that players make worse decisions when they're tired because you know, your brain
and
wants the oxygen.
Skills worse.
And your brain needs the oxygen, you know, it's all been taken up by the panting and, you know, all runs out, blah, blah, blah. Can you tell I'm not a sports scientist? But again, New Zealand is so stupid in the last 20 minutes. You can probably tell they're knackered, and it probably explains them going for pick and goes and everything more so if New Zealand is tired. And that, just coming back to the scrum, getting worse and worse as the game goes on, where France actually refresh it, you know, they bring replacements on much more easily, much quicker than the All Blacks do, and you get a sense of them getting really on top of the scrum because the All Blacks are tiring. Their packs start to look tired in that scrum.
Yeah, big time. And France are managing to clear the ball further and further all the time.
Boxies!
Yes, ENL. Ali Williams steals a key attacking lineup for France, which results in Sivivatu making a break downfield, passing the ball to Soa Oyalo, and they get up to the 22 and they go into the pick and go sequence.
Yeah.
And this time, it's much more effective.
Yeah. Jerry Collins, really key in this.
Yeah.
One of his last involvements, well, he goes off injured as well.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they get up, they get to within the line, and after last time, he was the one that knocked it on. Rodney Taiolo manages to flop over, sneak over, and put the All Blacks back in front.
It's starting to work, and it's quite concerning because France had been containing that pretty well, and it makes you think, like, is this going to be a turning point? But McAllister misses the conversion.
Yeah.
Pretty significantly.
Crucial. Slides wide.
Yeah.
And Jerry Collins, having picked up an injury, I think it's like he runs support during the sequence of offloads.
Mm.
I think he picks up an injury there and then kind of hobbles around in the 22.
Yeah.
He goes off holding his side. And the commentator's like, why would you bring Jerry Collins off? He's having a great game, which he was. And you're like, well, he's clearly injured. He's holding his side.
Yeah.
Come on, lads.
Yeah. And he was one of the better pack members for the All Blacks in this game. But the score at that point is 18-13 to New Zealand.
Yeah. It's all starting to slide in their favour, other than the injuries are starting to pile up.
Yes. And as you say, they're starting to tire. The scrum's getting on top. The French replacements are doing such a good job. Sarzewski absolutely blitzes one kick chase, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
Where Elisar boots it away.
Straight after the try. They clear. Really good clearance. Puts it long, managed to get the ball to bounce. So they've got time. And again, Sivivatu, they blitz up on him because they know he won't kick it back.
Yeah.
He won't look to pass. He will look to only attack himself. And yeah, Sarzewski's chase on this is incredible. Like, this is the
I thought it was the centre at first. Yeah. I thought it was like David Marty.
It's the sort of thing you see like a Dan Sheehan type modern hooker do these days, you know. Maybe a Theo Dan or whoever, like really good, dynamic, athletic hookers. He was so far ahead of his time here.
Yeah, yeah.
And he gets up there. He absolutely smothers them. And New Zealand force an offload, and then there's another player following up. I think it is Jozion. Goes for like a chop tackle, and New Zealand throw the most forward pass you've ever seen in your life.
So it goes about Rockefoko, is it?
I think possibly, yeah.
Yeah.
Lobs it like 10, 15 metres forwards. Completely forced. Not on. There's no need for it. No option there. There was no one he was really passing to because they were all covered as well. Just a really stupid, stupid decision. And it gives France a scrum.
So on their own 10-metre line at this point. And that is, once again, one of two turning points that happens in that exact second.
Yes.
The other one being Bernard Laporte rolls the dice and goes, it's time for Freddy.
We want Freddy as our fly half.
Freddy is a man of jouet.
Indeed.
That's a niche reference, especially to anyone outside the UK. Anyway, Freddy Michalak replaces ENL Boxis at fly half.
As France set for the scrum. He's still taking position. He's literally running on as the scrum is setting.
Yeah.
He stands in the fly half position, right? And the scrum sets. And the ball goes into the scrum. And as it's coming out the scrum, you go, hold on. Hold on. I know this clip.
Yeah, yeah. He doesn't really even set into the fly half position, does
he?
He's more in the inside centre position.
Sure, yeah.
Because Damian Tri flies up, and you know where this is going.
Yeah.
Damian Tri gets the ball as the first receiver, and he just fucking runs at someone. Like, the thing is, like, this is one of the most famous moments of the Rugby World Cup history for two completely opposite reasons. Is it that good a try? I don't know.
It's all right.
I think it's pretty good, but...
No, I think it's a great try.
It's a great try, but why does Damien Try do that?
I don't know. He's Damien Try. Why do you do most of the things he did?
I don't know. He was the sensible one.
I don't know about that, though.
By French 2007 standards, yeah. I suppose. But Damien Try just kind of runs into somebody.
Yeah.
And this is the important bit. Freddie Michalak drastically overruns him, trying to go for an offload.
Yeah. He pops it forwards. Michalak recovers and just keeps going.
Yeah.
He takes the pop. He breaks the line. He skims through. He gets up to the 22, right? And as McDonald kind of tries to lure around to get him, he gets onto his outside, does a full undefendable spin move.
Yeah, I love a spin move.
And pops it inside to Yannick Zhaugjian, who has timed his run perfectly.
It's a beautiful line by Zhaugjian.
Accelerates onto the ball as it flies in his direction, and he explodes through, makes up the try line. Everyone listening to this has seen the try before.
Yeah. You're right, it is a beautiful try. I'm being harsh on it.
Yeah.
Right. Arguably the defence isn't great, but also arguably the defence forced a forward pass. So
sure, yeah.
It's a weird one to judge. That is the decision that Wayne Barnes gets wrong.
Yeah.
And rugby is not black and white.
No.
It's open to interpretation, the laws of the game. Most of what is whistled in rugby, or not whistled, is opinion of the referee. This goes forward.
The pass is forward, right? Wayne Barnes at the time is refereeing a scrum. The French scrum is starting to get completely dominant. So there's a very decent chance they're going to go for an eight-man shove and try and get the penalty from this.
Yeah.
Right? Which is what a lot of teams would do when you start doing scrum penalties, which they have. Over the last kind of
also,
five
that's what allows Damien Try to run onto the ball.
Absolutely, yep. He's then having to backtrack round to get into position. This is more the linesman's call.
Yeah.
This is more Tony Spreadbury on touch there. Only be Jonathan Kaplan on that side. Jonathan Kaplan on that side. Phew, you don't have to blame Spreaders. This is Jonathan Kaplan's call more than Wayne Barnes. And he is happy the pass goes forward. He doesn't see it. And the TMO cannot step in at this point.
No.
That's what people have got really angry about since. Why didn't TMO say anything? Because we had TMOs at this point. The TMO could only comment at this point, the protocol, they're going to comment on anything in the act of scoring or inside the goal line.
You said, like, if you're a New Zealand fan and you're still pissed off about this, you're a baby, right?
Yeah.
I think the day where that became the case and stopped being a relevant thing is the day that they said, you know, you can go back and check something before the try line.
But
because
also,
they changed the law about it.
But also, it's the next 20 minutes.
The next 20 minutes do happen, yeah. Zhaugjian scores the try, though.
The amazing thing is, I had no idea this was Freddie Michalak's first involvement on the field.
Yes, me neither.
He's been on the field 30 seconds.
And suddenly he's causing chaos, scoring tries that literally overrule the laws of the game.
Yeah.
Like, running lines that you're allowed to pass forward
like,
to.
Probably the thing he is best remembered for is 30 seconds after coming onto a pitch.
Yeah. Talk about making an impact.
I know.
And also, like, the spin move is not what anyone would be coached to do in that scenario, and yet it works.
They say, like, oh, Michalak's made an immediate impact. And I was like, has he, though?
Mm.
He's just sort of come on and done something.
Yeah.
Does that count?
Like, it's not like he's fucked someone up in a tackle.
No.
Like he's... He just kind of got the ball and ran with it.
Yeah.
He didn't even really mean to get the ball.
It's crazy. It's ridiculous. It's just the most French thing I've ever seen. It's the most Freddie Michalak thing to come on beyond for 30 seconds, create the winning try, one of the most famous tries in the history of the World Cup, and then just go, yeah, I'll just sit here for the rest of the game. Who cares?
Yeah.
They nail the conversion, which puts them ahead.
Yes. Ellis Saad with the conversion. And yeah, it's 20-18 at this point.
Yeah.
And immediately after this, As you said earlier, you alluded to this, they kick to Sivavatu, knowing he's not going to kick it back, he's going to run it, and they go for a choke tackle in him.
Yeah.
They get Chabal in the middle of that and just go, right, you need to hold this guy up. And they get the put into the scrum, which they then dominate. It's just brilliant game management at that point by France.
Yeah.
They know exactly how to pin New Zealand back, put the foot on the throat. And
however,
yes,
the other thing that happens here is Nick Evans goes off injured.
Mate, I didn't remember that was a part of this.
No. I'm not sure what he did, what the injury was. He just sort of hobbles
he
off the sideline.
He looks very uncomfortable, doesn't he?
You just sort of see him on the sideline looking really uncomfortable, holding part of his body. And Luke McAllister has to move into 10, which thankfully they've got someone who can play 10 there.
And they bring on Isaiah Toyava to play in the centres, who has also played 10 subsequently, but at this point hadn't.
Yeah.
I was just saying, luckily, it does make you think maybe that's part of the reason why they pick McAllister. No, Carter's got an injury, so he might need an extra fly-off. Although that said, Aaron Major has played fly-off, hasn't he? So, you know, who knows? But anyway, Toyava comes on. They have to slide McAllister into 10. I think it kind of took him a moment to realise the reshuffle they were making. Because Toeava's first touch, where he comes in at first receiver,
and
forces this shit, dumb, stupid twat offload.
Well, because
what's he doing?
All of his games up until this point, even more so than Nick Evans, had been in games and New Zealand were dominating.
Yeah.
You know, he'd been coming off the
Scotland
bench.
Game, he tore up.
Yeah. He'd been absolutely the guy coming off the bench or starting in games against tier two teams and smaller teams who they were battering.
Mm.
He wasn't used to the situation. So he goes, well, I play for New Zealand. When I do that, I do lots of offloads and I do forced passes. And that's what all of this All Black team was. Because as you said, you know, this was remembered as a team of like almost kids who wore a grey jersey and weren't worthy of the black.
Yeah.
And so much of that is ultimately true because they've been so used to winning games by huge margins that they force everything all the time.
Yeah.
They're not aware of the occasion whatsoever. And this is kind of where it all begins to fall apart, I think.
Yeah.
And the thing is, right, New Zealand had two fly halves go off injured. They had their scrum half injured, and they had one of their two talismanic flankers go off injured, their co-captain, their
you do feel
vice-captain go off injured, right? Yeah. But they've lost all of these players, right? 98 of 100 countries in rugby would be normal about this.
Yes.
If they lost all those players, you go, well, you know, we lost loads of, we also all our key players injured. You know, it's a bit of an issue. But
proud of the boys.
Yeah, we're proud of the boys. Good effort, whatever. England and New Zealand would talk about this for decades as a great injustice.
Yeah.
England would go,
it's the fucking kit's fault.
Yeah. Shut up. You lost both your fly halves and your scrum half and bloody Jerry Collins in the space of 10 minutes whilst you're a man down, whilst the guy who ended up playing 10 was in the sin bin.
Yes.
Come on. But,
like, it's fine, don't worry.
Yeah, it's fine, it's fine. We can be normal about this. Like, England would have spent, like, a year talking about this as, like, the greatest atrocity and why we should shut rugby down. New Zealand would spend 15 years angry about this and use it as motivation to win two World Cups.
Yeah, it's true. In a sense, maybe that's vindication.
Yeah.
Who knows? Who knows?
But, like, if this happened to Wales or Ireland or Scotland or France, even, they would have just gone, eh, he's life.
Yeah.
And then moved on.
But Toeava throws this stupid dumb offload behind his back that goes about 10 metres forward somehow. Claire picks it up and nails what would be a 50-22
I picture Claire Thomas for a moment. Have you mentioned her earlier?
Yeah, Claire Thomas runs onto the pitch.
Probably
she's
about
got so
like
many
5 years old at this point.
Yeah, she's got so many talents. And yeah, she sticks the ball on her toe.
It's about the only job in rugby she hasn't done at this point.
Yeah, yeah. I'd back us a nail at 50-22.
Absolutely.
Though. And yeah, Vance Onclair nails what would be a 50-22 nowadays. The All Blacks do come back from this. They start picking and going.
Well, like, yeah, they try a chip in their own half.
Yeah.
From nowhere, on the back foot.
They weirdly get away with it, don't they?
Yeah, but I just have written in my notes here, each word individually underlined, manage the game.
Oh, mate.
Because what happens here is some of the worst game management I've ever seen in my life.
Agreed. Mate, when they get up to the 22, they're in the middle of the field, on the 22-metre line, dead between the posts,
well, okay.
Right?
So before this, right, around like 73 minutes, they have a long sequence of pick and goes. You have 20-plus phases again. They get up to within like 10 metres of the line. There's no thought of going for the drop
this
goal.
This is the one I'm on about. That's the one I'm on about.
No, so they get there. They have no thought of going for the drop goal. Dusitwa turns it over. They then kick it clear. They run it back and they get up to the 20. They run the 22 in the second.
Yeah. In that first one, there's a point where you think this is the perfect point to go for a drop goal. And McAllister hits a fucking hard line off 9.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
And it's just like, mate, you're the fly off.
Yeah.
Like, I don't care if it's a good line. Get in the fucking pocket.
Yeah.
Like,
at least set the option, make France think about it.
Yeah.
Because the French defence is thinking about the drop goal. You're not.
Yeah.
Why not?
And, like, I just have written down here, get in their pocket. They get, within 10 metres or so, Aaron Ordicke steals it on the floor. It's extremely risky for him to go for
sorry,
it.
Because
his hands go on the floor first, and then he kind of like flops on the ball. And some referees would penalise that. But Aaron Ordicke clearly knows what he can get away with. And also the rest on the far side.
Yeah.
And the touch judge can't call that one. So he's managed to steal the ball.
Michalak makes an absolutely terrible clearance.
Yes.
Where he kind of misses it
Jack.
Completely. Yeah. But then the only go back there's Chris Jack. If Sinifatu was there, he scores.
I know Chris Jack scored or set up that brilliant try against Scotland from the backfield, but also, there was a pick-and-go sequence 5 seconds ago. Why are you not a part of that?
No, but also, why is he the only guy that's worked back there into that position?
Yeah.
Why is it you replace
both
the
of those
row?
Things are shit.
Yeah. So why isn't... If they had a winger back there, they score this because it's such a shit clear.
That's
Rock
Fucker's element, man.
It's a kind of kick that only works in the Rugby World Cup 2011 official video game.
Yes.
Where you kind of hit it diagonally across the pitch.
Yeah.
Right? Terrible. Chris Jack gets caught easily, means he can only get up to the 22.
Yeah.
And then they set up and they get between the posts. So between the posts, they've already lost it once. So even McAllister thought, right, okay, we're on like, it's only like 74 minutes. We've got 6 minutes. We might as well try for a try and have another shot at the drop goal if we miss it. He's now between the posts. They've lost it once. And he doesn't consider it. He, again, starts running around, drifting around to the short side, like does like a flashback against the grain thing without any thought of setting for a drop goal. Doesn't call anything. Doesn't do anything. You're properly screaming like, what's going on? Sarzewski comes in and like disrupts the ball, managed to prompt, I think it's Bonaire wins the turnover in the end.
Yeah, yeah.
After like Sarzewski like forces a knock really on gets from McCall. Yeah.
And there's 90 seconds left at this point.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so France clear into touch.
Yeah.
Right. And New Zealand now, having blown two clear cut, the cleanest goal opportunities you've ever seen in your life, right?
Yeah.
One. No, two handed them on the 22.
Was there 2 points down in the biggest game of their lives?
Yeah. They have two chances on the 22-meter line for the fly to drop into the pocket and knock it over. They get 10 meters out from the line and they still don't work it in field in order to knock it over. They don't have any thought of this. They then have a line out set up and all it would take, right, is for them to go, okay, we blew those two chances. We've got 90 seconds to go.
Get it into
the 22. Hit one phase up in midfield. Send Soyolo, whoever, up in midfield. We're going to run one phase and then McAllister's in the pocket and we'll go for the drop goal. Leo McDonald can kick goals as well.
Either he'll get it or he won't.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
So they do the first bit beautifully.
Yeah.
Sivavartu crashes up in midfield, gets a really nice soft shoulder, and McCall goes for one pick and go. And you go, brilliant decision. Whilst you're on the front foot, go for that. And New Zealand all crowd around the breakdown and they get loads of men piled over there and the ball is slow and that's brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, you want the ball to be slow in a way,
sure, yeah.
So you can get set up. So you've got everyone piled into the breakdown. You're dead between the posts. You're on the 22-meter line. And that is the perfect point for McAllister to go, right, I'm going to sit back in the pocket. As I say, I'll either get it or I won't.
Yeah,
we've not got a setup for this, but you can improvise one. As I say, we're in midfield. We're in the perfect position for me to just kick the ball between the posts. As I say, I might not get it.
Yeah.
Who cares?
If you want to do a pick and go first to get few more inches, keep the defence honest.
That's valid.
Fine. Whatever. McAllister, either way, should be in the pocket set for a drop goal.
I just twatted myself over the head with my notebook because I just have written, what are you doing?
Yep. I have what's going on? No. Why no DG? What?
So McAllister flattens up on the right-hand side and tries to run this shit, dumb double switch move.
I'm not a Kiwi.
Why?
I'm furious about this. I would have loved France to win this game, right? If I was watching it live and didn't know the result. What is he doing?
And it gets worse. I've just thrown my notebook on the floor this time. So this move backfires. They go for this dummy switch, double switch thing. Rokothoko gets picked up and sent backwards. They're back onto the 10-meter line.
He tries to offload it. The ball comes loose and they're sent back further again. They're back, as you said, on the 10-meter line. They've lost all position they previously had. They're now in no position whatsoever. And one phase later, McAllister on the angle, on the half, in his
behind
own half,
halfway.
In his own half, goes for the drop goal finally.
So the thing that's most annoying is that shows he has the initiative, that he has thought about, oh yeah, we could go for a drop goal here, even though we've not got a set-up play for it. As long as I'm between the sticks, I can give it a go. And instead, he goes for it, as you say, on a shit angle, on the back foot enormously, with Dusatoir in his face ready to charge it down, with Chabal ready to chop his left foot off.
Yeah.
And he goes, yeah, okay, I'll just go for it now.
Yeah.
And obviously, he fucking slices it. It's a horrible, rubbish
kick.
The
ball has to bounce four times before it reaches the goal line. Where Damien Trai collects it and spends 30 seconds running back and forth.
Just dancing. I love this.
Me too. I think he could have gone for longer.
Yeah.
He eventually steps out to be a dickhead instead of putting it down.
Yeah.
But he goes for as long as he can until someone catches
Chris
up.
Marsoi's like squaring up to him like, are you going to put that fucking ball down, mate? And he goes, yeah, all right, fair play, fair play. And at this point, there's 10 seconds left as they're looking to take the drop out.
And this is one of the most interesting tactical decisions I've ever seen a team have to make, right? You're 10 seconds to go, so you pretty much know it'll be the last play.
Yeah.
When you kick off.
Yeah.
You've got a 22-meter dropout. You're 2 points ahead. What do you do? What do you do? It's such a rare situation, but it's so interesting.
They make the right decision,
in my eyes,
because they've seen that they don't know how to set a drop goal.
Exactly. So,
you don't need to factor that too heavily into your mind.
Your options are you kick short to try and regather yourself and put it out immediately.
Yeah.
You kick really high and shallow to try and prompt a knock on.
Yeah.
Or you send it really long in the hope that they won't be in kicking range.
Yeah.
Or you do what they do, which is they send it to about halfway, so they've got hang time on it, but they can still push them back.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the conservative option, but I think it's probably the right one.
Yeah.
It depends on how the opposition's playing, how good the owner's high ball, where the sun is in the sky.
Yeah.
You know, the roof was closed in the Principality that day, so there's all sorts of options.
What kit the opposition's wearing.
Yeah, of course, that's really important as well. But yeah, when you know they're not setting for drop goals, right, when you know the only thing you've got to watch out for is a try, and if they can conjure a try from halfway when you've got full chase on, so be it, fine. But New Zealand looked so harried and their attack looked shit those last few minutes because they looked panicked as all hell.
How flat is their backline in that last attack?
Too flat.
It's ridiculous. They're essentially side by side.
Yeah.
The way that they're attacking. And like, even if I didn't know the score of this, I'd look at that first few phases of that New Zealand attack and go like, there's no way
they're winning this.
You could tell me that they have the ball for 100 phases here, that guaranteed free shot, and I know that they're not scoring.
Yeah. And like, the thing is, if they were going to win it, it would be with a moment of bullshit.
Yeah.
Right? And they've got Sivivatu and Rokovako.
Yeah.
But they've got to get to the wings in that situation first.
Sure.
And I don't think there's anyone else on that team that's going to get it there. I think McAllister's managed his attack so badly.
Yeah.
He's managed the game apocalyptically badly.
Well, it screams to me that they've not been running McAllister at 10 in the week.
No.
At all. Or potentially all World Cup.
Yeah.
That obviously he's a really good rugby player. And he's an experienced fly half at different levels.
Yeah.
So he knows how to slot in at fly half. But it feels like he's doing it more off memory of what the other guy's meant to be doing.
Yeah.
Rather than actually playing there himself.
Well, because the key point around this, right, the key thing that's come up time and time again is the All Blacks hadn't practiced a drop goal drill.
Yeah.
They hadn't run a drop goal drill at all. They didn't have one.
Yeah.
They didn't have a setup that they won.
Not one that
they didn't
practiced.
Have a call they'd go for. The All Black coaching staff, Graham Henry, said since we probably should have worked on that. We probably should have had more of a drill
no
there.
Shit, yeah. Mate, have you seen the look on Wayne Smith's face when that drop goal misses?
No.
And they cut to him on the stands. Wayne Smith looks pissed. I don't know if it's himself for not
inventing
one,
be,
or
though.
Henry for not inventing one, but...
Yeah. Right, so in the last 10 minutes, Wayne Smith and the other coaches, suppose it was Wayne Smith's call, sent a message onto the field to Richie McCaw specifically that they should prepare for a kick from the field. Right?
And they go,
they
how
sent
do
this
you
message
expect
on.
Us to do that?
Yeah. They'd never won a drop goal drill before this, the All Blacks. They'd never won run one in training. If they had, they certainly hadn't run it with McAllister. Graham Henry said since he felt like they should have prepared them better for that drill. Richie McCaw said in his autobiography, to his knowledge, they never practiced a drop goal drill. It never came up. Because their plan B was that they'd pick and go to get penalties in order to do that.
Not be funny.
Which they didn't do.
Yeah.
Well, they did, I suppose, at first, like 73 minutes, and they stopped.
If you're coaching an under-11s team, you don't go on and go like, you know what, lads, I think... It would win if we spread out more, so should we do the 1-3-3-1?
Yeah.
Because they'll be like, we're not fucking practice that.
Exactly, yeah.
I know that it's not an under-11s team, it's the literal All Blacks.
Yeah, so they just figured, well, if we need a drop goal, like, Dan Carr can just do that.
Yeah,
It'll be fine.
And they've just gone like, oh yeah, why don't you practice that drop goal drill that we practiced? Well, like, there isn't one.
Dan Carr kicked four
You know that drop goal drill that we've done?
Dan Carr, up to this point, kicked one drop goal in his entire career.
Mm. Was that earlier in this tournament?
Was it? Maybe.
I think it might have been.
Yeah, but... All the same, right? He'd gone off. Nick Evans obviously has the famous one against Stade Français in a few years' time.
Mate,
but,
quality kick that.
Yeah. Luke McAllister, nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. And so, what it comes back to
again,
is them blaming Wayne
it,
Barnes.
Who cares?
Yeah, it comes back to them blaming Wayne Barnes because they didn't get any penalties when there was no penalty offence by France, right?
Yeah.
And when you look at, when they talk about this, right, when you read the New England press, and particularly with Graham Henry talk about this, says, well, we had all the balls, so surely we'd get a penalty. Like, go over that and point to one penalty offence France give away.
Yeah.
And there probably are some, but there weren't things that were being refereed then. You know, there's one where Solzeski, I think, goes off the save on the ball, but he let it go because everyone let it go at that time.
That Aaronautica won't get pinged nowadays.
Yeah.
But also, he took a risk then and it worked.
Yeah.
So, good on him.
I don't think
he's
there's
a world-class open side.
There's not a clear penalty offence that'd be consistent with the way the game was refereed that day as well as in that tournament and that
and
era
by
in
that
general.
Ref.
That should have been there, right? And there's a general thing of like, oh, the All Blacks didn't get a penalty in the last 20 minutes, a single one. So therefore, it's corruption. Like, no, like, because France didn't give any away.
France kept their discipline.
France kept their discipline and they were sensible.
Their defense
and instead,
was class.
New Zealand end up in their own half, throwing these silly balls until eventually Shabar clatters into someone. There is a drop ball as well. It's Barnes rules is going backwards, which kind of gives them a bit of leeway. Yeah, until eventually Chabot clatters into someone and comes up with a ball on the other side. They hand it back to Ellisard, who runs backwards 30 metres down the pitch.
I love it. It's
and
so petty.
Belts it into touch as everyone loses their shit. I love, though, that the players are celebrating. The fans aren't, because the fans in the stands.
Get it off you will the like, pitch, get off you the moron.
Let's not do this again. Let's not play with fire any harder.
Yeah, I do kind of love it, because, yeah, they're not ready to celebrate. It's like, no. Do we celebrate we've got the ball, but we've not actually officially won yet? Yeah, no, we have.
Yeah,
okay,
cool. Phew. Brilliant. Thank you.
Phew, we beat the All Blacks. Yeah. Imbanez goes nuts on the sideline.
Yeah.
Where he's on the bench and like he's on like his second bench back and he hurdles the first one, which for a man of Imbanez's size is a feat. And there is the famous shot of Dan Carter's head going into his hands at that point.
Yeah.
And the commentators are saying this means that no matter what, these coaches are getting fired. Graham Henry's getting fired. Steve Hansen's getting fired. Wayne Smith's getting fired, which obviously happens, right? Yeah. If you want to know what happens there, listen to our 2011 Rugby World Cup series in full, and you'll know what happens to them.
But yeah, so there was a very long and far-reaching review of this process. The thing Jamie Ward's talked about this podcast before, right? Yeah. New Zealand need to win the last game of the year, because otherwise the entire off-season just becomes people talking about why the All Blacks are terrible and all the coaches should be fired.
Yes.
And if they win that last game of the year, everything's fine. If not, it throws the following season off completely. And New Zealand went out here, right? And so we had a far-reaching review which looked at all of the possible factors. The biggest one they put it down to was the lack of preparation properly. The fact that all their pool games were soft-touch games. They didn't get properly tested at all. And that became a real issue. They figured that was the biggest factor in them going out.
And they coasted for all of those games, by the way. You know, they didn't try and run specific drop goal drills against some of those teams.
No.
Or something that might resemble that they're then going to turn into an attack.
The conditioning program was the other big factor they pointed to.
Okay.
Right. Was that stuff we talked about, right? That running that thing that just knackered all the All Blacks out at the start of the season. All of this kind of landing really, really poorly. There were some issues around selection, whether they got selection wrong as well, which is a weird thing to question in the official review. But regardless, they did eventually decide to keep Graham Henry, which was a really controversial call at the time.
Yeah, I bet. Because that is a very early exit for the All Blacks.
Yeah, the earliest ever.
Yeah, usually you expect that they make the final or at the very least lose the semi-final by a point.
Yeah, exactly. This was the earliest they've ever gone out. Wayne Barnes has since said, yeah, of course it was a forward pass, but I wasn't in a position to see it.
Yeah.
Yet, I don't think that's especially relevant to the result because New Zealand had 850 billion opportunities to win it in the last few plays and they couldn't do it at all.
I'm going to repeat what I said earlier, pretty much word for word. We've watched 100 plus games of the Rugby World Cup for this podcast specifically, and I do not know if I've ever at the World Cup seen a team blow it as hard as New Zealand did here.
Yeah.
That it's factually untrue to say they've only got themselves to blame, because obviously the Wayne Barnes forward pass did happen, but
also,
I think 99% of the things they have to blame are the New Zealand National Rugby Union team.
But the fact that 5 years later, Graham Henry saying was match fixing.
Yeah.
Couldn't point to an...
Fucking grow up, man.
Grow up. Grow up.
You know what? With that, Graham Henry's my dick of the day.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Right?
I was going to go for Luke McAllister because of that bloody thing he put us all through.
Well, yeah. Me too.
I'm not going to argue with that.
I had Luke McAllister down as my dick of the day for a while. I had it as El Asal for some reason at some stage, and I can't remember why. But yeah, my dick of the day is Graham Henry because he not only bitched and moaned about the referee...
Yeah.
thing. And Graham Henry, right, I will preface this by saying, went on and fixed this in 2011 and went
to
become, go down in history as one of the greatest rugby coaches of all time. I will not argue with that because he's
the
a
great redeemer,
the
after all.
Indeed. However, at this specific moment in the week leading up to this game, he was arrogant enough to think there is no chance that we're going to be 2 points behind at any point and the opposition will have good discipline.
Yeah.
You know, that they won't be able to defend our pick and go. So I'm just not going to bother introducing just an emergency drop goal drill. Run it once in training and go, Sam, that's what we do if it comes to that. It takes 3 minutes to teach them that. Run it through once, do it once more at full speed, and then do it. So Graham Henry did not prepare for this quarterfinal.
Why are amateur teams better prepared than the All Blacks?
Yeah.
To have drop goal drill, to have a basic drop goal drill. Just to set someone in the pocket, just one call means to smash it up in first phase, maybe have some pick and goes around the fringes, forward set positions blockers, and the bloody 10 to knock it out over.
So, you know, a head coach and a world-class head coach, like, let's not patronise him here. He's a world-class head coach who fundamentally did not prepare properly for a quarterfinal.
Yeah. Really interesting quote from Dan Carter when asked about this game, right? Mm. said, if I could change one thing in my career, it would have been to start paying more attention to the mental side from the start.
Okay.
The defeat to France in 2007 was a huge lesson. Under pressure, we withdrew into ourselves and stuck purely to what the coaches had told us.
Right.
We stopped thinking.
That implies there's a conversation on the pitch.
Yeah. We stopped thinking. We learned then that all the time you spend in the gym and on the training field, not enough of it's done in terms of mental preparation.
So there's definitely a conversation in the field at some point about, do we try and just make up a drop goal drill?
And do we do something? We haven't been taught this.
Somebody's probably bollocked them on the sideline and gone like, no, don't do that. That's not part of our plan.
Does it happen?
And then it comes on 10 minutes later and it's set up for a kick.
In reverse,
what does that mean?
In reverse, when that comes on, right? And McAllister's then going, well, do we want to back ourselves and back this? Or it becomes a back and forth of they're knackered, their conditioning isn't right, and they don't know how to run these plays.
Yeah.
And it becomes a huge, huge issue for New Zealand.
On one hand, that call came on 10 minutes too late. On the other hand, it came on 6 weeks too late.
Exactly, yeah. I can't stress how poor they were in the last 20 minutes.
Yeah, they were
shite. I think we've done a little bit of that.
Yeah.
But, like, it's really hard to convey. It's one of the... I'm going to be hyperbolic here, right? But I think I stand by it. I think it might be the worst managed last 20 minutes I've ever seen.
In terms of pure game management,
from
exclusively world-class players.
From a capable team, this is the worst managed last 20 minutes I've ever seen. And any team that plays that badly in the final 20 minutes deserves to lose by more than 2 points.
If you've got 15 of the best rugby players in the world on the pitch at that point, you should win that game.
If you don't know, like this France team, right? Doucetois is incredible. Sarzewski, Chabal, come on, are brilliant. There's lots of players who play very well in it. I don't think it's a great French team. I don't think it's a fantastic French performance. I think they defend very well.
Defensively,
it's not a complete day of brilliant
178
French rugby.
Tackles by France.
Yeah, which is not,
not bad. And New Zealand only made like 40.
Yeah.
Genuine
I think
stat.
It's a good performance by France. I don't think it's a playing out their skin performance they probably thought they'd need to put in to beat the All Blacks.
Sure.
I don't think they were at the standard they expected to have to be in order to win that game.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the All Blacks did them a solid.
I don't think there's any world, New Zealand have been the best team in the pool stage by a long way. I don't think there's any world in which they deserve to win this World Cup based on that performance. If you
Agreed.
Can't win this game, you deserve to be going home at the quarterfinals.
As long as you have like the bones of the team that France did.
Yeah.
Because they've got enough world-class players, just enough world-class players, that they should be able to put this performance together.
Yeah.
And it should be expected of them.
It's just terrible. Just absolutely terrible for New Zealand. And like that dominates, quite rightly, the conversation around how they land that year. The same thing Jamie said about winning the last game of the year. But they didn't know how to win a tight game. And obviously they come around and they change that in 2011 and really go much further in 2015.
Yeah.
But it then bites them on the bum later on, right? And there's that big turnaround with South Africa winning and then everything going from there. And them not knowing how to ride that momentum and change. And it's been an ongoing problem with All Black rugby's against a period of dominance where they then don't know how to win a tight game when they get into it.
Yeah.
There's an argument that's happened with Ireland, you know, could be coming with Ireland again after the it happened in the quarterfinal. But yeah.
Can I ask you a question?
Please.
Who's your dick of the day?
So Luke McAllister was there. I was thinking just in general the All Blacks for putting me through that and being the best team in the world but having no idea how to close out a tight game. But I can't argue with Graham Henry. I'm going to go with Graham Henry. Because it just leads us on to Man of the Match, which I think will be a shorter conversation.
It's interesting because there are a lot of players who do play well. Personally, I'll go with my list. I did have Dan Carter written down around sort of the 45-minute mark. I was like, I think he's playing really well here. But obviously, I did know that they eventually lost and that he goes off. And then he does go off and it's a bit of a turning point. Do I think they'd win with him on the field? Maybe. Because he might have the initiative to actually call a drop goal drill. Because he was the most composed fly-off probably of all time. Save for Roman Untermack now coming through.
Yeah.
But, yeah, him on that side. And Ali Williams, I think, is just exceptional. I cannot understate how good that guy was at just wreaking havoc all game. But for me, there's two players who stood out above the rest. I've not spoken too much about Fabian Palouse, but he's so good in this game. And works his socks off, hits an unbelievable amount of breakdowns, and brings the fear factor for 80 solid minutes. And I've got so much time for him. I think he plays an absolute blinder here. But it's not by as much of a landslide as maybe thought it was going to be, but still a significant difference. My man of the match is Thierry Doucetois. Yeah. He makes 38 tackles, you say, scores the try, and as the game goes up further and further on, the moments that he's causing get bigger and more important and more catastrophic, and he is ruining the All Blacks' life more and more. That once those tackles, because there's a compilation on YouTube of all the tackles he makes in this game, which is brilliant to watch, but when you put them in context, it makes you realise that as you get further into the game, there are more important tackles, and that turnover is ridiculous. So Dusa Twatham out of the match for me.
The first half an hour, he's standard.
Yeah.
Right, he's like a good international performance by a flanker.
Yeah.
The next 50 minutes, he's unreal. It's the best you'll ever see anyone play. And yeah, for me, Thierry Dusatoir is nailed on man of the match. Palouse, you mentioned, really good call. I think Dmitry Chozeski might be, in the minutes he plays, the second best player on the field.
Pound for pound.
For pound is phenomenal.
Yeah.
And then there's lots of, like, I think both centres play well. Yeah. I think you kind of have to take them out of consideration for the way McCarthy eats through them a couple of times.
Mm.
But I thought David Marty was really good.
McCarthy's a very good player, though. So,
yeah. Elisard plays well.
He does. I really like Elisard.
But yeah, I think ultimately... Oh, Bonaire as well.
Yeah.
Julien Bonaire and bloody Aaron Ordicky plays well as well. Wins that turnover, almost scores the try. But ultimately, yeah. Thierry Dussatoir wins. France emerge victorious. Fantastic couple of bits. So they went out for a meal in Cardiff altogether after this game.
Oh, nice.
Because they didn't want to go out and celebrate too much. As Fabian Palouse said, because he played in that 99 game, where they obviously came back and won. He said, the context is the same, but this is very different. This year we had more going for us. We knew what we wanted to do in 1999, where we hadn't been going to do anything. This year, we said it loudly, we want to be world champions. In 1999, that game, we won one state of euphoria. Basically, France went out and got really, really pissed in London for like two straight days after the game in 1999. Where here, they were like, we should probably just have like a bite to eat and a couple of glasses of wine. apparently, Michelac drank more than anyone else.
Of course he did.
However, the person who drank the most, right, worth saying, is Doug Howlett.
Oh.
So the big thing that comes out in response to this game, in the fallout of this game, is 2 days later, New Zealand go to get their flight home to New Zealand from Heathrow, where Doug Howlett, on the way to the flight, was arrested.
Oh, shit.
On suspicion of causing criminal damage by jumping on two cars outside the hotel at Heathrow Airport.
When you say dumping, you mean he like had a shit?
Jumping. Oh, jumping.
I thought he'd like sat down and like had a big fat dump on them.
No.
Can we just say he did for the sake of this podcast?
Yeah, he did. Howlett himself described the incident as tomfoolery.
Yeah,
it's a beautifully old-fashioned
word.
When
you have a shit on a Fiat, it's usually tomfoolery.
Basically, right, the night before they went home, the All Blacks all went and got really pissed together, really drunk.
Mm.
And Doug Howlett got arrested for damaging someone's car by jumping up and down on top of it repeatedly.
And pooing on it.
I'm doing a massive shit. But yeah, he left there, signed for Munster, and there we go. But yeah, it was a really, really interesting game. The fallout in both directions was huge. France advanced the next round. I feel we've kind of done the New Zealand leaving party.
Yeah. Oh, we don't do them for the quarterfinals onwards anyway, so it's fine. But
and so, that brings us to the end.
Yeah. What a journey that's been.
I know. One of the
most
iconic games. That's been a fantastic look over. Fantastic to dive into.
Because it's a real piece of rugby history. And
yeah.
Essentially, that's what this podcast is about, and we like celebrating the small ones, but, you know, it's nice when the big ones actually do deliver like that one did. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
It's really interesting, because I think we both had quite a similar perception of the game that was both different from how both of us thought it
would be. Very different to what
be.
I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
In the game.
I think that's good. That's good. We've come out generally in agreement there, because there was part of me thinking, like, you might just think, like, I'm just shitting on New Zealand too much, but you were arguably shitting on New Zealand more than me.
Yeah.
That's good. That's good.
Great.
I love this podcast.
Well, in that case, if you love this podcast as well, why not join us next week?
Yo, who's on next week?
For the third quarterfinal.
Oh, is it us again?
Oh, God. Never mind. Between Scotland and Argentina.
Oh, that should be good. Maybe.
Another historic day in the rugby.
Yeah. No, that should be a good game. That should just sounds like a banger.
Yeah. I know. I remember Graham Love talking about this game when he was on this podcast.
Okay, I don't. So
detail enough that I now know what happens and where Argentina's win comes
if
from.
If it tickles Glove's fancy, then in the bad way, all the
yeah,
good
as
way.
A moment of tragedy that he remembers well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, I'm looking forward to that in that case because you know what? I really want to see the Scottish backline play once more together.
And you're going to get it. And only once.
Let's go, Marcus Dorollo.
We'll join you next time in your house when we come into your ears and sing about the rugby for you then. Thank you very much. We'll see you then. Good night.
Good night and thank you to YNL.
Don't wear grey. Don't do it. It's a fashion disaster.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.